Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under The Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course. To the Carpcast, introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chops. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie. Ooh,
yeah. So hello and welcome to episode 52 of the Carpcast. Coincidentally, I'm just looking at a picture on Facebook of Dave Gilley, who's having the session of a lifetime. I presume he's on home fen, but he's literally this second just landed a 52 pounder to go with the other 340s he's had since yesterday or the day before. Some going, Mark. Have you got a 52?
You know I haven't.
I was going for the tenuous link.
I've caught a 52 that was spawned out. Does that count?
Yeah, it's also been 51, 52, 53, 56. In fact, the next 10 episodes can definitely cover that fish.
Right up to 60.
61, wasn't it, one time?
No, it was... this is my memory. Stuart Taylor had it at... That was bang on 60. And then Cy Gibling, I think he had it 60 pounds, 6 ounce. That was 260 captures.
Okay, the fat lady jokes will officially be gone in 8 episodes times. The fat lady intros. What you've been up to, it feels like a while since we've spoke.
It has been a while. You've been gallivanting around Europe, and I've been busy out with the JRC crew, making some promo filming for new products that will be launched on YouTube later on this year. And it's my first time doing that sort of thing, and I know you've done bits and bobs before, but it's a lot harder work than what you think.
Yeah,
fun, though.
It's surprising who's kind of natural in front of the camera and who isn't. I mean, I seem to have a great face for radio, but I'm extremely comfortable. I'm extremely comfortable talking on camera. And some people, you know, I'm not going to name any names, so I don't want to embarrass anybody, but I've been with people filming who are larger than life, you know, life and soul of the party, real outgoing characters, and put the camera in front of them and they're tongue-tied. They don't know what to say. It's awkward. And I've seen it. You know, people who you wouldn't expect really surprise you. They just flow in front of the camera, and some people just freeze up. It's a funny thing, that camera. But I guess more people are getting used to it with selfies and stuff these days. You know, people are getting used to being narcissistic, I guess. Whereas it's not as uncommon to kind of play up for the camera. But I guess you're all right with it, were you?
Yeah, it wasn't any speaking things. It was more just like, you know, product demonstration. And I tell you what, I'm not going to give the game away, but there is some epic shots. And I'll give him a shout out, Basil, the cameraman. He is a perfectionist and so good at his job. You know, you can tell where he probably needs to get out more, but he's that passionate about his angles and his light levels and the equipment he's got. Wow. I was impressed.
Yeah, the camera people know their stuff, don't they? I've, as you know, been on a bit of an adventure. Spent the final part of it in Amsterdam with the Nash guys, some of the top anglers from from around Europe, really. It was a very multicultural, but one guy in particular was Ollie Davis, who I'm sure everybody knows, extremely good cameraman, or good, doesn't really sell it, you know, he's fantastic behind the camera, and maybe we should get him on as a guest actually at some point. I'm sure he's got lots of stories about the people he's been out filming with. I know he's very good friends with Nick Hellier, somebody I would also like on the podcast. Ollie has said he would try and hook that one up for us. But he obviously follows Alan Blair around, and I've witnessed Alan Blair's angling a number of times, and it's nothing, the guy is a machine, it's nothing short of breathtaking to watch him operate. He's just been on a 2-week trip around Europe, and I'm sure this is public knowledge now because I've been posting stuff on Facebook, like little teasers, but they basically filmed Eurobanks 3. They've been in a load of countries, Italy, France, Austria, finishing in Amsterdam. They might have done another country, actually, I can't remember. But I met them in Amsterdam. We ended up going to a drum and bass festival on Sunday, just gone. And I mean, you never saw Alan. We were supposed to meet there for a social. He'd invited a load of people. He had a guy fly over from England, who's he knows from Mother and Toddler Group for his little. And there was Dutch anglers there, the Bastille, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, so I'm not going to bother, the Czech guy who were on the last Eurobanks on Bled with Alan and Ollie. It was a Belgium angler, top Belgium guy. I mean, it was you know, very, very European. There was no Brexiting going on there. These are all fantastic angles, but Alan, he just doesn't stop. Ollie said for 2 weeks, and there was no exaggeration here because I watched it with my own eyes, for 2 weeks they've not been in bed or attempted to sleep for more than 3 hours in any day. Because Alan is just up, he's everywhere, he's baiting up, he's, you know, looking at spots. He's just a stalker. He finds carp wherever he goes and he catches them. He harasses them to death. I've never seen anybody like it, and I've never seen anybody with his worth ethic. I know he does like 20-hour days at Nash. I know he's always done that. He'll get up at 3 o'clock. He'll get in at midnight. He'll get up at 3 a.m. to do emails because it's the quietest time of the day. You know, as soon as everybody comes in the office, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, you can't do anything because the phones are going and, you know, Kevin's there, and it's ridiculous. I mean, I've said for years, Alan's going to, you know, work himself into an early grave because the way he works. And his fishing's just the same. It's exactly the same. He just doesn't sleep. We all had a fantastic social. I managed to get one rod out for about an hour and a half. I was attacked by the worst mozzies I've ever experienced on the side of this lake in Amsterdam. And I ended up reeling in about, I mean, we got heavily drunk, completely wasted till about 2 a.m. And I think my rods were reeled in before 3, and I was sleeping in the van with the door shut. I must have 100 bites on me. It was unbelievably hot as well. So it wasn't like you could just. I had no mozzie now. I wind back a little bit. So I've gone to Bled, Lake Bled in Slovenia. Everybody will know it from Eurobanks 2. If you haven't watched it, you need to because it's amazing. One of the most spectacular places I've ever been, but there's no night fishing on there. You're not allowed to set up a bed chair or a brolly or anything. So I had very light equipment, very mobile gear. I had all my scope gear, scope rucksack, the scope unhooking mat, which I have to say right now is amazing. That unhooking mat saved my life over there. It's basically an unhooking mat that folds up into thirds. And then clips onto the top of the rucksack. It's like two clips on it, and it just clips in, but it doubles up as a seat. Reedy, who runs the Northern Angling Show with us, used to work for Nash. He ended up flying out to Bled with us because it was so amazing. He flew out for 3 days. He wasn't meant to be going. Flew out for 3 days and then stayed for a week because it was that amazing. Cancelled his flight and booked another flight to go home. But obviously he had no equipment, so he was sharing our equipment, and he commandeered that unhooking mat. He was sleeping on it every night. You know, it's a bed, it's a seat, it's an unhooking mat. It clips to the top of the rucksack. Fantastic bit of kit for something very simple. But Where did I start with this? Yeah, so the Bled experience was very light. And obviously, when I got to Holland, I had no kit for, you know, like general night fishing on the big open water. So I got eaten to death by mozzies. I will never go back there again without mozzie net and brolly. Get this one. This will make you laugh. So I was away for 2.5 weeks. On what was kind of a fishing holiday, and I didn't catch one fish, not one, in the whole time.
What is your excuse?
I haven't got an excuse. Amsterdam was never going to catch a fish. I fished one rod for about an hour and a half on a point where there were 7 or 8 people, all with a couple of rods out each, in any gap that could be found on this point. There was just nowhere to put a rod. So discount Amsterdam. Lake Bled, I was there for 9 days. I didn't fish at all for the first 4, because basically there was 3 of us until Reedy turned up. Then there was 4. We all had our girlfriends there. My girlfriend came with me on, like, because we went on a bit of a European road trip. We visited Germany, Austria, you know, basically a camping holiday in my camper van. With the tent on the side of it. So the other girls were flying in, and they weren't arriving until the Wednesday, and we got there on the Saturday. So I decided not to fish until the other girls had arrived, so not to leave Rachel. By this time, there were 2 areas doing fish, and that was the 2 shallow areas, the casino and the snag tree, both the areas where they caught on the Urban Banks video. They're both, one or two people pegs, really, and Matty and Spenny were in those pegs and had quite a few fish by the time I'd even thought about getting my rods out, and all that was left was deep water. The locals told, we had local contacts over there, shout out to Gasper, he's a Slovenian chap, came down, seen us a few times, gave us the info, but basically they all fished the deep water, 15 metres, 45 feet is like the what they reckon the depths for the big ones. He's saying 5 key a bait every day, build the bait up. As soon as you've got 20-30 key in there, you catch lots of fish, loads of big ones. That's how the big ones get caught and whatever. So I kind of, they had, Spenny and Matty were fishing the only shallow pegs, and I decided to go on a deep water plan, you know, based on this information. Nobody caught a bite out of the deep water. The trip finished with, between Reedy, Spenny and Matty, they probably had 30 fish, maybe. They certainly had more than 30 bites. They lost quite a few fish around the snag tree and stuff. Not a single fish came deeper than 22 foot, I think, was the deepest one Matty had. The majority were between 10 and 20. Now, the average depths on Lake Bled are 35 to 60 foot. There's probably 5% of the lake that's got, that you can get 20 foot or less. 5% or less of the lake, maybe 2% of the lake, you can get that deep. And I couldn't get in any of that water, essentially, by not fishing for the first few days. It was kind of commandeered. I stuck out with my deep water plan, you know, got some heavy bait going and saw a couple of fish show over it, but I just don't think they were going down in that water. I mean, I was fishing in 60 foot in one peg. The fish do get caught from there, but I didn't catch. In hindsight, I fished it badly. Don't blame anything or anyone. I don't think I fished it right based on information I was given from people that turns out don't fish in the summer. Like when we, you know, after further questioning, getting to know these guys a bit better, it's like, oh, well, we don't fish in the summer. You know, it's too busy, too many tourists. You know, we fish like October, November, December. It's like, well, obviously the fish are going to come out the deeper water then. It's bloody 35 degrees. You know, Matty was onto it. Shout out to Matty, but Matty Lightfoot, or Matty Dark Hands, as we call him. Matty was onto it straight away. He wasn't comfortable fishing in the deeper water. He was just like, it's hot, the fish are going to be in the shallow water. And, you know, he was fishing the only shallow water pegs. And Matty had the session of a lifetime. He had a number of 20 kilo fish, up to 49 pound, I think, was his biggest. Some fantastic looking fish. And he had it off, really. He had the session of a lifetime. He had a really, really good session. He was catching from start to finish. He did 2 weeks on there. I mean, the last two nights, something I could have done, which I didn't, and we found it out on my last day, and luckily Spenny and Matty had two more days and they really made the most of it, was the beach area around the campsite, which, I mean, I was doing 10 miles a day walking and bike riding with 20 to 25 kilos on my back, you know, rods, bait, rucksack, everything. And there was an area in the beach which has shallow water, 10 to 12 foot. It's like a man-made beach by the campsite. It's really close to where we were staying. I didn't have to do the absolute slog. I mean, there was a toll on my body from the walking and bike riding that I was doing every day. Yeah, I mean, it's a good few miles around the lake, and I went around it at least twice a day, sometimes more. Walked around it, cycled around it. I was exhausted, you know, really aching. And all the fish are caught within the first hour and the last hour, because you're not allowed to do nights. Virtually all the bites were between 10 and 11 p.m. or 4 o'clock in the morning. So if you imagine fishing till 10 p.m., you might be on the far side of the lake. It takes an hour to pack up and get back to the campsite. Back to the campsite at half midnight, and you've got to be up at 3 to have a chance of catching the next morning. You try doing that for 2 days in a row, and it's game over. You've got to have a day off. Which is it's killing you. You know, it's a really difficult lake to fish. It's not the fish are in there. There's plenty of fish in there, and they're amazing looking fish. But it's super hard to fish. And in hindsight, it's not a holiday to take your girlfriend on. I had an amazing holiday there. I didn't have an amazing fishing trip there. I'd had loads of nice meals. We did bobsleighing at the top of the mountains. There's like a ski slope there that has a dry bobsleigh run in the summer. We had loads of nice meals. The scenery, everything is stunning. However good you think it is from pictures and videos, it's 10 times better. The place is amazing. If the lake had no carp in it, I would be going there for my next holiday. Anyway, regardless, I'd be taking the family. The place is absolutely amazing. Nicely priced. I mean, apparently Bled's really expensive for Slovenia, but it's, you know, significantly cheaper than England. We arrived, you know, on the night we arrived about midnight, we bought three large beers and a double vodka and mixer, and it was like 12 euros, like a tenner. And that, you know, I said to the barmaid, wow, that's cheap. And she nearly fell over. What? That's cheap. Like, she couldn't believe I thought that was cheap. You try getting 4 pints and a double vodka in England for to anything shy of 20 quid, you know, you're going to struggle, aren't you? The place was amazing. In hindsight, I fished it wrong when I did fish, but I probably didn't fish. In the 9 days I was there, I bet I didn't fish 20 hours with rods in the water. And probably 12 to 14 of those hours I knew I wasn't going to catch. It was just daytime where I was just sunbathing, wanted the rods out anyway, but you know, it's red hot in the middle of the day and all the bites were coming last hour or first hour, even for Matty and Spenny. So you know, I'd probably over 50% of the hours that I fished I knew I wasn't going to catch. You know, I was just fishing in 35 foot of water at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I just had the rods out for the sake of it. Some days, bear in mind it's 57 euros a day to fish as well. It's expensive. Some days I fish for an hour. You know, by the time if you didn't get up in the morning because you were knackered from the day before, you do all the daytime stuff, sunbathing and chilling. You go for a meal in the evening, the meal's late, somebody doesn't turn up, the restaurant's busy, whatever. By the time you get out of the meal, it's 9:45 at night. And you've got to stop fishing at 11. So I was like, it's a rush to get in the peg, get the rods out for an hour. I mean, it was worth getting them out for an hour because that's the time you get the bites. But, sometimes you just paid 57 euro to fish for an hour. And that happened a couple of times. And I fished it badly for the time of year. I listened to what people told me instead of doing what was natural, which like Matty did, and Matty had a fantastic session. So I will be going back. I will be going back at the earliest possible opportunity I can. The place is amazing. I cannot speak highly enough of it. As was Holland. I'm going to do a bit of fishing in Holland as well, I think. I bought the year-long permit in there, and they're just all, you know, like our country. I mean, what percentage would you say are public waters against privately owned waters? you know, like open access waters that you can just jump on and fish, like free or for your rod license. Like 1%, 2% of waters in the country.
Very, very few. I can think of a stretch of the Trent, and that's about it off the top of my head.
Yeah, there aren't many
waters.
Yeah, they're all privately owned, aren't they? Or day circuit lakes. In Holland, it's the opposite. There's probably 5% owned waters, and the rest are public because they're just all waterways. So you know, every inch of water in Holland's got carp in it. It's unreal, and you know, and they're not huge. The top Dutch anglers, they still go travelling to catch big fish. You know, they still go to France and Austria and wherever to catch big fish. But 20 to 25 kilo fish, which is obviously 40, low 40s to 50 pound, they're not uncommon in all these lakes. They've virtually all got them in. Well, you can't even call them lakes because they have ships going down them and, you know, sports boats and jet skis and everything. They're just, I think water, obviously Holland's built on water, and water is just part of their nature. You know, everybody barbecues by the lakes, his families, and I really liked the setup. You know, there's no rules on these lakes. You just tip up, you know, get a boat out, get a bay boat out, you know, get a dinghy with a motor on the back, tow out 300 yards, whatever. It's like, it's kind of anything goes. The water seems to be there for everybody. For 55 euros for a year is what I paid in one of the pet shops in Amsterdam. I can go back whenever I want. If three of us went there on the ferry, on the overnight ferry, I'd use the Hull Rotterdam ferry. If three of us went on that ferry, it's actually cheaper than three of us driving from Blackpool to Oxford and then all of us paying, you know, fishing for 4 nights at 30 quid a night on a day ticket. It's actually cheaper for us to go to Holland. And the choice of water is unreal. They've all got 20 to 25 kilo fish in. You can take boats, you can take a load of bait, there's barbecuing on the side of the lake. Just, I really liked the word I'm looking for, but just the setup, you know, the culture of water that they seem to have over there. You know, everybody enjoys it and uses it, whether it's, you know, for swimming, for barbecuing. And I can see me doing a hell of a lot more foreign fishing over the next few years. It just seems more fun and more of an adventure, and you know, you're less restricted by, you know, syndicates, waiting lists, other anglers. I mean, the campsite we stayed on in Amsterdam was called was by a lake called Hasp Plas, which is just outside Amsterdam. There's a campsite near then. It was near the festival that we went to on the Sunday. And I cycled round it two nights in a row around the entire lake on dark, looking for fish. It's not one of the more popular lakes in Amsterdam. It's probably 350 acres, I would say. It's pretty big. The locals that I got speaking to, that you know, Alan hooked us up with, Alan Blair, really clued up the area. They knew straight away. They went, right, there's about 250 fish in there. A lot of the big ones got nicked years ago, but still 250 carp in there. It's a big lake, so if you do get on them, you know, you're going to catch. But they're quite old and wary fish, and you know, they sent me pictures of the two biggest, both mid 40s, and I was like, that's a nothing lake for over there. There wasn't a single angler on there 2 days in a row, not one in 300 acres. I was just, and you know, and there's two mid 40s in there. There's a number of 20 kilo fish in there, and fish looked amazing. I was just like, and this is a lake nobody really bothers with, because there's, you know, plenty of other free lakes that are better. So I can really see myself going there. You know, if there's two or three of us and we're like, you know, where should we go? Let's go and do a social day ticket session somewhere, rather than all going to Oxford and paying 30 quid each for three or four nights. Let's just jump on the ferry and go to the dam. It always feels better when you're kind of on a holiday as well, doesn't it? It feels more exciting. So I've rambled on a bit about my trip, but I hope it's inspired somebody, because I'm going to be doing that. I really enjoyed the camping side of it. As a quick link, we had an email from Bev Clifford, didn't we, about a book that they've released, called Open Access Waters in the UK. Have you had a chance to have a look at that yet?
Worth a look.
Yeah, I've had a quick flip through, and the first thing you do is, even with the old BK 1000 Waters books years back,
yeah,
that were our Bibles, you know, the first thing you do, you look in your own area, you look for the waters you fished, and you know, there's quite a few good ones in there. You know, all the ones you'd expect in there, and even a few ones you wouldn't expect are in there. So it's certainly worth a look if you're, you know, at a loss, fancies trying somewhere new. There's plenty of suggestions in there. 500. A few European venues are in the back section as well.
Ah, I didn't know that yet. This Bev sent it. It's my old address. I moved quite recently, so Bev wouldn't know that. It's a friend of mine that's actually moved into the other house, so I will be able to retrieve the book. So I'm quite interested to read it. Obviously, I've been away. I'm literally back for yesterday and today. We'll knock this out briefly, and then I'm off to a camp festival, which is a music festival, like a family music festival on the south coast, taking my daughter who was 16, shout out to Megan, happy birthday for yesterday, taking her and a mate down to this festival. But yeah, I'm intrigued to have a look at it. If you want to check it out, you can get it from the usual place, which is www.giftsforanglers.co.uk. I think they have an eBay shop and an Amazon shop. You could pick this book up for $14.99. I think they do it on Kindle as well, which is like $5.99. In fact, Bev has said we can give a couple away if we would like to.
Worth a look.
So competition, what do you think we should do? And I'm not guessing the weight of my next fish again, because that put me under a bit of pressure.
If we guess the weight of my next fish, Lord knows, I've just done a 2.5 week blank in some of the best waters in the world. And I tell you, let's do something relevant to what I've just spoke about.
Yeah, it's a problem nowadays. You can't ask any general knowledge questions because someone puts it into Google and yeah, everything answers there.
I tell you what we do. We'll give 2 books away. And if you have caught a fish from somewhere off the beaten track, that is a free water. So like in France, you can fish the public lakes just by buying like the, you know, it's like a rod license kind of thing. In Amsterdam and Holland, you can do the same thing. You can just buy that €55 ticket that I've just bought, and you can fish any of these open waters. So if you've caught a fish in the UK, there aren't many open waters that you don't have to pay to fish, that are just kind of free fish with your rod license, but we'll include England. If you've caught a fish from any of those waters in any country, send it to us and we'll pick the 2 nicest fish, not the biggest fish, but the 2 nicest fish, we will send, and we'll send you a copy of these books.
No.
We send it to our official Carpcast fan page, which Heapy Bob runs. You can send it to that. If you're not a member of that, then I suggest you join it. Or then there's our actual Carpcast business page on Facebook. Send it to that. Or you can Twitter it to us at the Carpcast, is it?
It is at the Carpcast. Now, should we play some tenuous links? Because some of it's been popping to my head then.
Yeah.
You mentioned Heapy Bob, who runs our Carpcast fan page. Heapy Bob is going to be on our Royston social, which is coming up very, very soon. And we've had a couple of cancellations, so if anyone messages me very quickly, there is spaces available. I did have a reserve list, which I'm going to try and dig up. I've got it somewhere on my computer, but if anyone's listening, get in touch if you fancy it.
Yeah, there are spaces. The Royston Lake, for people who don't know, is the brand new day ticket lake opening very soon from Nash Lakes. Everybody knows what Kevin's done with the Church Lake and the Copse Lake. This is his latest venture. I know it's stuffed full of fish. Congratulations to Matt Rhodes, by the way. Shout out to Matt. Matt used to do some bailiffing on Cromwell. Matt's got himself a job running the Nash Royston Lakes, working for Nash. He posted up his contract a couple of days ago that he's just got. I know he's been down there doing a lot of work. Congratulations to Matt. Yeah, but these lakes, they are stuffed full of fish. They haven't been fished. Bar the odd people putting rods out doing work parties and stuff to try and get them open, building the pegs and everything. They're supposed to be absolutely beautiful, and we have exclusive access to the lake for the Carpcast weekend. It's on my birthday. It's the weekend of the 12th, 13th, 14th of August. which is my birthday on the 14th, so we'll be having a good old social on the Saturday night. You can get coaching from Alan Blair, advice from myself and Mark. Mark's a level 2 angling coach, as you may know. We'll spend time with all of you. Alan will be doing a talk on the Saturday night. Fired Up Barbecues are going to be supplying the food. If you haven't checked out their food, it's amazing. Check out our video from the Cromwell social or firedupbarbecues.co.uk. We'll put a link in the show notes where you can find them if you want to book them for an event or anything. But Richard does one of the most amazing barbecues I've ever seen. We supply food for the weekend. We supply the beers on the Saturday night. We'd get some coaching from Alan, myself, and Mark. And obviously you get exclusive access to Fish This Lake before it's open to the public, and it's only £250 per person. So if you would like to fish, please get in touch. We would love to have you there. It's going to be about 20 of us. 25 is an absolute maximum, but I know we've done like 22 places and you reckon a couple have dropped out. So there is space, but I wouldn't hang about because there's probably not more than 4 or 5 spots. But yeah, contact myself or preferably Mark for the info.
Yeah, I've got to ask also, do you know what else is happening on that weekend which makes going to Royston quite a big sacrifice for me?
Go on.
Because up in Caton Park is the Bloodstock Festival. With bands like Twisted Sister playing the final UK gig, Slayer, Anthrax, Dragon Force, Goat Whore, Evil Scarecrow, some classics, and I'm missing it. So if I'm walking around the lakes on that weekend, singing death metal to myself, that's why. And Fear Factory, who's another tenuous link, whose former bassist is Christian Oldwell, was a carp angler.
There's a few famous rock carp anglers. Julian Cundiff seems to know most of them through his famous friend Duff Batai, that does all the tour managing and stuff. I don't know what he does, artist management in the UK for a lot of these bands. But one of my childhood heroes is a guitarist called Adrian Smith.
Iron Maiden.
Of Iron Maiden, yeah. I mean, him and Dave Murray, the other guitarists, were my heroes when I was a young budding guitarist many years ago, 35 years ago, something like that. They're still going strong, and Adrian Smith's a keen carper. I've seen him out with Julian, and Julian did mention he might be able to sort it out for me to go fishing with him at some point. So if you listen to this, Jules, I haven't forgotten. I would love to meet Adrian Smith in person. He was such an influence for many years. I could play every Iron Maiden song. First one I ever learned was probably the hardest. I had the name then in my head. It's an instrument, like a 2-3 minute instrumental that they did, guitar piece, and it's gone. Not Phantom of the Opera, it's gone, can't remember. So yes, Julian, I would love that. Very jealous. He's been to Europe this week as Jules in a rock festival. I noticed their pictures. They were another band that were pretty big in the 80s. Everyone will know the Final Countdown, I guess. But yes, should we pay some bills? Pinpoint Hooks, Mark, tell us about them.
Pinpoint Hooks? Well, we all know what an edge having mega sharp hooks are nowadays. Well, they always have been, but we are now able to put amazing points on our hooks, and even I can do it with my Cumberland sausage fingers using the Pinpoint Hooks sharpening equipment. That's pinpoint-hooks.co.uk or pinpoint-hooks.de.
It's a German site, yeah.
It is. But the good thing about that is when you're checking out, if you use the code CARPCAST10, you'll get a 10% discount.
I've noticed pretty much everything we mention. I mean, we do have a couple of advertisers, DNA being one of them, Pinpoint Hooks being another. We've had some others, but sometimes we just mention products because we like them and we use them. Yeah. And everybody seems to assume there's a CarpCast discount code for anything we mention. Have you noticed that? I've been getting messages quite a lot recently of the pop-ups, the super stinky pop-ups that I got from Baitworks. Baitworks are not a sponsor of the show. we interviewed Mark Bryant, who makes all the bait, the genius behind it, and he was kind enough to send me some of these. They stunk the place out, and Mark messaged me actually saying that the post office have actually tried to block their account because they stink so bad. They've had many problems, many delivery agents, and these things do stink, by the way. They're called Scent from Hell. I mentioned them because I really like the fact I've got the stinkiest boilers in the world, and I haven't caught a fish on anything yet, let alone them, since I've had them. But I'm going to flick them out every now and again. But people are like, where's the discount code for the Scent from Hell boilers? I can't find it. It's just like, no, Baitworks don't advertise. They would like to, but obviously we have a bait sponsor, which is DNA. Which we're very proud of. They supported us from the off. But yeah, you're just going to have to buy them. Sometimes we just mention things because we like them, not because you can get a discount. But it always helps if you do buy them and you say that you heard about them on the Carpcast. That will definitely help us. But going back to the pinpoint hooks, I never cast a hook out anymore without touching it up, either with the file or the stone. And they do the sets as well, don't they? You can buy ready sharpened hooks. They do their own hooks, which are basically the ESP. What were the ESP ones called, the amazing ones that they did? And then
you're in the Ace ones.
Ace, not ESP.
Yeah. Ace razor points. Now Pinpoint are calling their next gen plus hooks.
Yeah, and they're amazing. Reedy and Spenny were using those on Lake Bled where we've just been, and blimey, they are sharp. They are super, super fine, point all the way up. You know, when we file our hooks and we try and get them down to like a pin, almost really thin, that's how these next gen hooks come, isn't it, when you buy them? So you can get these all from pinpoint-hooks.co.uk. You can get the full sharpening kits that have the eyepiece, the clamp, the two types of diamond files, and you get two stones with them as well. I wouldn't go anywhere without them. If I feel naked if I haven't got them, because every time I reel in, even if the sharps, I use the twisters and they're pretty sharp out of the pack, but by the time you've had them in the water overnight or for a few hours, and I'm tired, I don't like tying new rigs and using precious hook link and hooks, I just touch them up again with the pack, and it's saved an absolute fortune. Anyone who doesn't have a hook sharpening kit, whoever makes them, is missing out, because it will save your fortune in hooks and hook link material. But yeah, you can get a discount on all this stuff. Carpcast10, use the code for the 10% discount. DNA Baits, as I mentioned, are also a sponsor. They do loads of decent stuff. Their most popular boilie at the minute is the Switch. Some good friends of mine use the S7 very regularly, but they do all sorts of post-free deals. Some people have been asking us about the Zig deal, which I believe has been taken off currently. I guess that's because spring has gone when it's kind of the most one of the most common methods. But you can still get a fluoro pop-ups package deal, a fluoro candy sticks package deal, fluoro wafters package deal. They do two deals of boilies. The deal one comprises of 5 Kia boilies and a pot of hook baits. It's only £45 delivered to your door. There's a deal two, which is 5 Kia boilies and a pot of hook baits and a litre of your choice of liquid. Any of their liquids. They do a fantastic liquid range. Check out the Mark Holmes last interview on the Carpcast for details of how he tore apart deepings using liquids, delivering them in bottles and all sorts of stuff. He was putting the liquids in the water. They also do the same deals, deal 1 and 2, for 10 key and 50 key as well. They do a special 50 key deal of freezer bait. It can be split into two different sizes if you want. You get a pot of matching cork dust wafters, cork dust pop-ups, and a litre of hydro wheat or beta stim. It's only £320. DNABaits.com is the place you can find all this, and you can use the offer code CARPCAST5 when you check out and get a 5% discount on pretty much anything. And I recommend checking out the shop on their website, because they have loads of decent stuff. There's a great range of liquids. The boilies are fantastic. I know a lot of very good anglers that are extremely proud to be using them. And we are too. Next time we will be back with another DNA tip of the week. I've been away for a couple of weeks. We haven't had a chance to speak to anybody, but I promise you we will get some tips on how to use some of the DNA baits by some very successful anglers. So one of the guests we keep getting asked for a lot, one of the OGs of British carp fishing, I would say, or of the hierarchy of British carp fishing, is Ian Chilly Chilcott, and I believe you spoke to him, Mark.
Oh, I did. I had a wonderful chat with him. There's an hour and 10 minutes of the interview, and it wasn't just that. I also recorded a bunch of extra material with him as well for the subscribers. We are on that as well as we speak. That is, we've not forgotten about you. But, well, just listen to Chilly, or... I enjoyed it, and hope you do too. Here he is. Yeah, I've just started, and I've got a welcome to the Carpcast. He's a guest, he's an author, he's caught a ton of big fish, and I'm sure when soon as you hear his booming voice, you'll recognise him. Ian Chilcott, how are you, Ian?
I am very, very well, fella, and before I forget, thank you so much for inviting me onto the Carpcast. It's a real pleasure.
No, it's a pleasure to have you on, and... I looked at your Facebook the other day, and I've seen a picture, it jogged my memory back, because I've, always read the magazines, and is it really 20 years since you caught Jack from Horton?
I feel old now, but yes, it's 20 years. It's incredible, absolutely incredible, and a moment in my life, let alone carp fishing, that really changed everything.
Yeah, definitely. And I remember your friend Keith doing, I think was it about 4 or 5, maybe 6-part articles in Cartworld all about Horton, and what a place it seemed at the time.
It was incredible, and as much as, I mean, it is a completely different water today, whatever anybody says. They're trying to sort of drag up the history. It was such a difficult place back then, and but it was as much about the anglers that were there as the fish and the fishing. It was just such a brilliant environment. I fished with Dave. There was our bucker, Reg Bampton was there, Springgate, Richard Stangram. There were some fantastic people there, and the whole experience was just absolutely brilliant. I loved every moment of it.
Yeah, and you've seen a sort of place as well where, one person caught a kipper and everyone was happy for it. Everyone joined in. Is it like that?
Yeah, but you've got to remember that's a different environment than it is today as well, and this is, carp fishing is carp fishing, whatever way you want to look at it. But back in the day, if you caught a 40-pounder in the middle of the year, you had a massive celebration for a kickoff, but then you went and had some fun, catching smaller fish all over the place. Nowadays, you catch 140, and the next day you're waking up wondering where the next one's coming from, because there's so many around. But those fish in Horton were totally, totally unique and very, very responsible for the massive industry that employs so many people today. Yeah, and they deserve an awful lot of credit, bless them.
Yeah, definitely. I'm certainly one. Like I say, I was a little influenceable kid at the time, reading about the likes of Horton, anglers like yourself, Dave Lane, and Raisby as well. And you were still in the army back then, so time must have been really limited.
The thing was, again, and I don't want to talk too much about it. Lynn was very, very ill. She still suffers massively today, and I was in the Airborne Brigade. I was a paratrooper, and I basically, it was an army within an army, and when things got so bad with Lynn, I got called in one day and they said, listen, if you can go fishing, go fishing, but the rest of the time, you just need to look after Lynn and just report in once a month, so I could sneak off and do a little bit of fishing, probably a little bit more than I did before, and that helped massively. One of the greatest allies you'll ever have in carp fishing is time. I don't care what anybody says, but it opened up so many doors, and I saw carp fishing in a lot of respects for what it was. It was, and ultimately, it was fun. If I look back on Horton, the first thing I think is fun, and somewhere in the midst of time, I caught some big fish there, and yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful time.
Yeah, I think that the F word, fun, that just sums it up. I mean, when I fished this week, it's the first time I've fished with you know, a fellow who I first met on Elstow years back, and it was, you know, so, you know, we're talking, you know, about, you know, 15 years back, and you know, well, two things. One, it was so much fun catching up, and the second, he can still drink and I can't. I still found that out.
Brilliant. But, brilliant. Do you know what? You spoke about Keith earlier on.
Yeah.
I mean, Horton was one big party, I have to say that. Rightfully or wrongly, you know, and in this day and age, it probably would be frowned on, but he sent off one of those articles you were talking about earlier. The title was called The Sultans of Swig, and it went off to Carl Wilson, and Tim wouldn't put that in as a title in the magazine, which made me laugh. But yeah, it was, you know, there was some awesome fishing done, but ultimately everybody there just, you know, wanted to have some fun, and I think that particular F word needs to get a lot more airtime in this game, and maybe people will not be disappearing up their own backsides trying to be something that it is impossible to be in this day and age. But there you go, only my opinion, of course.
Yeah, the F word, it should be in capital letters as well, I think. Now,
yes, totally agree with you.
Yeah. Now, there's another, you know, so I know I'm going back in time a bit, but I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, but like a kid talking to his favourite rock star, because I've read so much about you over, you know, and your exploits over the years, and, you know, you went to Raisbury as well after Horton, you know, like, you know, following in your friend's footsteps. And that's, quite a jump.
I think it almost like a natural progression. I had spoken to the management at RMC, as it was at the time, and explained that I didn't have the time, not with Lynn being poor, and obviously coming up to the end of my army career as I was, there was going to be an awful lot of things. And what I thought I would do is spend my time just walking around Raisbury. It wasn't like I wrote loads of articles, I didn't have to fill magazine space or anything. And yeah, I went up there, and I'd spoken to Dave a little bit about it. But I like to make my own perception of wars. I don't want too much information, you know. I want to go to places with an open mind. And but I have to admit, I'd been there a couple of times to see Dave when he was fishing there. And if you're not looking at a water of that size and with so few fish in it, I mean, there were probably 15 fish in there then in 120 acres of water. If you're not looking at it from a fishing point of view, it doesn't really matter. But when you stand, you drive up that peninsula and look across what was the North Lake, and then drive and look at the South Lake and think there's only 15 fish in here, it makes you shake in your boots a little bit. But the sense of adventure, I think that was the biggest thing about it. And I used to look at Dave and Phil, and I'm not a jealous kind of guy, but I was pretty envious of the way they fished and the fun they had over there. So yeah, it was a great time fishing at Raisbury with our Dave.
Yeah, definitely. So they're like, you know, your first impressions are just, like I said, 15 fish in, was it 120 acres, and it's shaped like a jigsaw piece. There's like two main lakes and bays. And
it's so hard to I mean, most guys turn up to a lake, man, there's like 900 fish in 5 acres and all the rest of it, you know, and that's just the environment that people are creating today. But back then it was you know, it was an incredible place. And remarkably 3 weeks in, I think it was my fourth or fifth night on there, I caught marlins at 38.5 pounds, which was, you know, all I ever needed, really. It was a remarkable, if that had been the only fish I ever caught from there, then I would have been happy. But it was a difficult time for me anyway. Yeah, I was coming up to the end of my army career. Lynn was just had so much going on. I mean, she spent more time in hospital having operations for years, and she spent at home. So again, I was limited for time, but I probably let the whole thing, Raisbury became an escape for me in the end, and probably for quite a few months, you know, the fishing went on the back seat. It was somewhere I could go and disappear and try and forget about what was going on in the real world. But it was an incredible place, and in the end, it put my brain back together, and I have a lot to thank it for.
Yeah, just that big chunk of sanctuary.
Yes.
I think that word sanctuary pretty much sums up my fishing, to be honest, a lot of the time. No work, no bills, no bullshit, basically. It's just you and the fish.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that is one of, I don't know what you call it, a responsibility, or one of the things that carp fishing can do. It can take you out of the real world. And very often give you that little bit of time, quiet time to yourself to come to terms with things, you know. It's different things to different people, isn't it? But it can do anything but help you, I don't think, and that's what it should do.
Yeah, I mean, just going back to Rays, we went from, you know, 15 fishing, and including the Mary, the former British record, and have you been back to fishing in its current form with RK Leisure?
I have, not as it sounds. It sounds a little bit. I'm not trying to talk it down at all, because RK Leisure, I think, I know, saved it from becoming a housing estate. So we should all doff our caps to them and thank them very much. But they obviously, with that amount of investment, you need to make money. So it needed stocking. They've cut the lakes in half now. So you've got Raisbury One. And the South Lake is a completely different entity, but there's still some big fish in there. I think there's 8, maybe 12, 4 is in there, and all those other ones are going to grow, and I think it will be a spectacular place, but at this moment in time, you know, it's not where I want to be, but somewhere down in the future, hopefully, you know, there might be a return to Raisbury on the cards. That would be quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, King Fungus is still swimming around as far as I know in there, and that's quite a desirable fish.
So. Absolutely, but I caught it twice.
Really?
Back in the day.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and back in the day, it used to be called the Dent.
Yeah.
And what we believe, and nobody is really 100% sure, there were 6 mirrors put in there. They were called the Fungus Mirrors.
Yeah.
Which is another little Raisbury store we could come to, and a couple of them died, and everybody thought that it was one of those fish. It probably was, and I was fishing in the Rockets, which is a swim just up the road from the Rocky Barge in the North Lake one day, and I caught it at 19 pounds.
Yeah.
And bless its heart, I caught it a few days later as well. So I don't think they really count. I am not into going back to a lake to catch a fish simply because it's bigger. But it was a very young and naive fish back then, and maybe one day I will catch it. But yeah, an incredible carp. And even in that environment with all that competition for food, it still isn't getting caught very much. So it's still a very, very highly prized fish.
Yeah, definitely. And I believe there is one or two other originals still swimming around. You know, is it?
Well,
there's a kid I know from Lincoln, Neil White. He had, I'm sure he'll, you know, correct me, but he had a 41-pound common on a trip down there. And
are you thinking of Jacko's common?
I am, yes.
Yeah, because I never caught that. I wouldn't hate to give anybody the impression that I did, but that and one other fish are the originals, and the other fish is called Rosie. And there is an incredible story about that. I've been all weekend at Raisbury. We're talking 98 now, the summer of 98. And I was with my mate Reg. Keith had been there on the Friday, and Reg came down on the Saturday. It was something like 1 o'clock on the Sunday now, and I've had a bite off the end of Brian's Point and played this fish in, and it weighed just over 22 pounds. And again, people thought it was one of these fungus mirrors, and we still didn't know. All I cared about is I'd caught quite a spectacular mirror from Raysbury, and a bite from there was a bite, and it really meant something. The following year, a guy walked into my swim, and that wasn't the following year, it was later on that year, and I thought I recognised him. I was up in the North Lake there in a swim called the Lawns, and I was like, sure I know you. He was on his way to Blenheim Angling Club to get his barbell ticket sorted out, and all of a sudden I realised who it was Kenny Hodder. And along with Peter, had entertained me for so many years, you know, and wonderful guys they are. They really, really are. And I gave him a picture, and he didn't recognise it to begin with, but he took it away. And in the end, I found out it was a fish called Rosie, and it hadn't been caught for 16 years.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last person who did catch it was Peter Springate from the Rocky Barge area, or probably even from Springate's Point, 16 years before. And, you know, we talked about that 29 pounder from that unknown place earlier on in those questions. And it's one of those moments in time. You didn't quite realise at the time, but when you find out the details, it just absolutely blows your mind. And it's one of those spectacular things and those moments that carp fishing can produce.
Yeah, David, 16 years is mind-blowing. That's...
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. It's, and quite frightening, really. You know, it's... You know, people go on about carp's intelligence and all the rest of it. I don't buy into that at all. I think the carp do things, you know, are quite individual, feed in different ways, and probably feed on different things. I don't know. But, you know, giving them intelligence for getting away with it for 16 years is a little bit too far of a stretch of the imagination. But, to me, it's one of the greatest carp I ever caught, and by a long way, not the biggest, but then that isn't what necessarily motivates me.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned fish like that. I spoke to Steve Briggs recently, for this podcast, and we're talking about the Mia and the big common in there that never got caught. And he was telling me he saw it a couple of occasions, but totally ignored bait. The only time he ever saw it feed, you know, when there's been an algae bloom and you get like the greeny, bluey, crusty crap that goes into a corner. Yeah. It took a mouthful of that in.
It was feeding in that stuff.
Yeah, oh well, just eating the algae, and I'm not sure how we get that on a hair rig.
No, you aren't going to do that. It's interesting you should say that, because I mean, I've had some crazy conversations with Laney over the years, but I remember when he was over there, and he was talking to me about exactly what you were talking to Briggsy about.
Yeah.
And he was in a little corner. There was the no fishing sign in the corner, and he'd seen it there. And I think he spent a couple of days, I think he knew that he was never going to get a bite, but, you know, sometimes you just have to have a go. You know, there could be that chance. But I think there's quite a lot of fish around that are just like that. I don't think, you know, there's a lot more of them than people know. The little estate lake I told you about up in Northampton, there's a fish in there. I saw it loads of times. Never been caught, ever. And a lot of the others have been. And you wonder what you have to do to catch it. But isn't that why carp fishing is exciting? I don't want to go fishing knowing that I'm going to get a bite every time. I want to go fishing knowing that I might get a bite from a very special fish, and I think that's what motivates me.
Yeah, me as well. I mean, when I was on St. Ives Lagoon, we had, I think it was about 12 or 13 fish. They all had names, they were known, and, you know, all very, very desirable, including the big girl. But, you know, that and, you know, 8 billion bream, and, you know, some big roach as well at the time. I believe Zen and Bodko was actually trying to catch the big roach in there.
Really?
Yeah, it might have been before I was there, but I know he had done. And I'm on this high bank looking down, and there's half a dozen cricket bat common swam past. And, you know, the lake had not flooded for a good 4 or 5 years at that point. I was like, where the hell have you come from? You never ever heard of them getting caught.
Yeah, absolutely. That is amazing.
And that was a pressure pod.
I love stories like that. That's what makes carp fishing so exciting. I think if a few more people chased those dreams around, then, it would be a better place. But anyway, again, just my opinion. Yeah.
No, man, that's I think the good thing about, not just carp fishing, but any sort of fishing, it is, a bit of a sanctuary. It's an escape. It's not to be taken too seriously. It is what we do as a pastime. And
yeah, absolutely. But it's still, some people have let it ruin their lives, let them drag themselves into the mire. And I've never, ever quite understood that. I've got incredibly zoned in on particular fish. Only have to ask Lynn about a few of them. And I can think of nothing else. But I got to a point, I think the carp I laid taught me an awful lot in the end. I'd had a couple of fish, and then all of a sudden I thought I was the greatest carp angler in the world. And I stayed there, and it chewed me up, to be honest with you. It absolutely chewed me up. And in the end, I never went back. It was horrible. But there you go. So, you've got to keep it in perspective, I think.
Oh, that's a great word, perspective. Although, I do remember the fish out there, the Dustbin and Single Scale, if I'm right, and what a pair of proper fish they were.
Well, the thing was, I always go, it's like when I went to Raysbury, I thought, okay, we're not going to concentrate on Mary. I want to catch Malins, because I just loved Malins, Obviously, the ultimate prize was Mary, and I caught Malins, and I was so excited. And when I went to the car park, the one fish, and I think I actually believe that I wanted to catch it more than ever, was Single Scale, and to catch that was just incredible, absolutely incredible. But wonderful place, taught me a lot.
Yeah, I remember back then reading in Big Carp when they used to have the walk around Yateley in there, and it was literally reading that sort of stuff, which made me think, right, I needed low stock water to fish. I've caught all of my doubles and the odd 20 for my local pond. I'm ready now. Totally wasn't, but. when are you?
But then that's it. There has to come a point, and I think it's whether you're ready or not, I think it's in your mind. I've had a few, and I want to catch a big one, and I think as long as you're motivated for the right reasons, go and have a go. Even if you aren't actually that experienced, if your mind is telling you that's what you want to do, then go and do it. Don't sit around. Someday, it is a very, very dangerous word, and it in general means it's never going to happen. I never say someday. I say I want to do it, and then go and do it. And to that end, I fished most of the most difficult waters around, and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, I've had this conversation, with a couple of friends when they've been thinking, I don't know, I want to go fish so and so place. I tell you what, St Ives was one. He was fishing, some of the other lakes on the complex, easier lakes, and I say easier lakes. He was fishing the shallow lagoon, which is obviously a bit different nowadays. But then it was not busy. The fish were about, each fish was probably about 15 pound lighter than what it is today. But he's I want to go on the lagoon with that lady, but I don't know if I'm ready. I don't know if I'm good enough. I said, mate, you can catch fish on there, can't you? I said, like, a carp's a carp. Go and do it. So you get one bite.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is probably the best statement that's been said in this whilst we've been talking. A carp is a carp. If there's less carp in there, you're creating less competition for food. And that's what makes them difficult. If you go to Braise Nose One and stick a load of corn out in the middle, or a couple of zigs and spod some sloppy stuff over the top, you're going to catch loads of carp. And you just, again, have to get this whole thing in perspective. If you're fishing a very low stock lake, then you have to change things. And, but they are, at the end of the day, as you so rightly said, they're carp, and that's how we should treat it.
Yeah, I've got to tell you this one. I've actually just written about this in an article for Carp World. I don't know if I got my slides off in time, because I had to dig on my old slides. That was an experience. I just loved going through them. I could have literally done it for hours. Just looking at my old pictures.
And, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, but it was when I first started going down to Elstow too, which, my first trip down south, and after, seven nights over several sessions, I caught a fish. It was like, wow. And it was like that moment where afterwards, because, I thought catching the fish was an experience, because there was no one else on pit two. The only person on pit one was a fella with some like deerstalker hat stalking the reed, stalking Rudd in the reeds. So I went over.
Really?
It was Chris Ball.
Really? Really? Yeah. Oh, bless him.
Yeah, so I was like, well, I was a bit taken aback at the time, and well, obviously did me some brilliant pictures, but yeah, it was like afterwards, it's kind of like, wow, I've caught one after seven, wow, I can do this, it took me another 2 years to get the one I wanted, but I enjoyed every minute.
Yeah, there are empty moments, aren't they, once you realise you can catch them from these places, and they change your whole mindset then.
Yeah, that is it, the mindset. I was going to move on to another water. I know you had quite a good time on with a ton of commons, Frimley.
It's amazing, absolutely amazing. Shall I give you a brief history of what I wanted to go there?
Go on.
It was I don't want to spoil, because obviously my third book is going to be released late October, early November, and the opening chapter sort of, I've expanded a little bit more on my own fishing, why I got where I did, and because I think it needed to be said. But all of my life, I wanted to catch, from the age of 6 years old when I first looked at Stillwater Angling, Walker's book, was to catch a common comparable to his.
Yeah.
And Frimley's Charlie's mate became that fish. And people say, oh, well, yeah, it took you 3 winters to catch it. Well, it was the only 40 pounder in there when I was fishing. Yeah. There weren't any others. I think there's 9 or 10 in there now. Isolating it was a difficult thing, but what a place. I mean, I did a little bit in the summer. I'd nip over there and catch a couple, but my main thrust was through 3 winters. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. My only problem was the use of bait. It's so near to home, I could keep bait going in there all the time. And it was, to actually isolate an individual fish in those circumstances is impossible. And I just had to sit there, keep catching them, and hopefully the big girl would put in an appearance. But she did in the end.
Oh, definitely. And there's one of the reasons I want to mention Frimley is because winter baiting. This is something that, I know we mentioned it before in the questions, but I just want to go a bit more in depth. Because a lot of people in the winter, they think, oh, little bags of little stinky fluoros or 8 million gallon of maggots. You get the boilies in a lot of them.
I do. The thing is, and I'll go back to what I've said before, I don't want to nick a bite. I want to nick loads of bites. Do you know what I mean? And the way to do that is to create competition. And the first thing I would say is, don't go and waste your money and buy 10 kilos of boilers and throw it in the pond. That isn't the way to get to using a lot of bait. You have to start, you have to find areas that you can bait, areas that you're going to get bites from, and then increase the bait. The amount of bait I was putting in there was ridiculous in the end, but obviously the results spoke for themselves. But it took me probably in each of those winters two and a half months to get to using a lot of bait, because I had to make sure they were going to eat it. Once I'd found those spots, then I was there every night baiting up. And it's one of those things you asked about getting obsessed with things earlier and it affected your life. I did nothing when I was fishing at Frimley. All I did was go up there baiting up and fishing it. It was incredible, but those fish wanted it. They were all running around with mainline sweatshirts on by the time I finished, that's for sure.
Yeah, probably a few pound heavier as well.
Well, they were. I think it did them a real favour. Ironically, one of the bailiffs there, this is in the second winter, came round and said, oh, can there's any chance I can get some bait off you? And I was on the NRG at the time. And I gave him a few kilos, and he came down that weekend for a social with his friends right at the other end from where I'd been baiting. And he put like a 3 or 4 bait stringer out on both rods, lobbed them out in the lake, and he caught Charlie's mate at 40 pound 4 ounces over the weekend. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I thought. Hey, it's a good description of how I felt. But it just made me more determined to catch it. But yeah, by the time I'd finished, those fish were just, they were just having it. And people say, oh, they don't eat boilies, they can't digest this, they can't digest that. The worst thing you can do if you're a lake owner is allow people to throw loads of maggots in. Sanders, just up the road from Frimley, would be a great example. People used to go up there with their bait boats, which I don't necessarily agree with, and fill it in with maggots. And those fish that you'd had 7 or 8 quarters in the autumn, by the end of February, they'd all be £37 because they're just getting nothing out of it. I wouldn't have them on my water, but there you go. It's that's just the way I feel. But they eat, if you keep fish food available, and it doesn't have to be tons of it in the winter for fish, they'll keep eating it, and that's how you maintain results. But the irony of all of this is I didn't necessarily catch Charlie's mate in the winter.
No.
That's the funny part about it. When the day I caught it was the first day when the spring ticket started, and the lake had never, ever been that busy since I'd been on there. And at 10:30 that morning, I think the 10th of March, those tickets started, was the morning I caught it at 44.4. And as soon as the photographs were done, 5 minutes later, I was pushing my barrow off the lake, never to return. And brilliant memories on a wonderful, wonderful lake.
Yeah, and you mentioned Dick Walker's Common, that was 44 as well, so, you know.
Well, that was it. It was everything, if you like. That was, you know, what was I then? I was 47 years old, so we're talking the end of a 41-year dream. Yeah. And it meant everything to me, and I'll be brutally honest with you, I nearly stopped carp fishing after that. Not because I didn't like it, but simply because I had achieved everything I'd ever wanted, and I just thought I'd go and find something else to do. And thankfully, I didn't, of course. But that's how I felt for a couple of weeks after. And it was a remarkable day for me, very, very proud of that. And just a great place to go fishing too for me. Yeah. It was wonderful.
Yeah, oh, rightly so. And there's just one more question on the heavy baiting side of things, because I'm sure, like, you know, there's a lot of people out there listening. They'll be thinking, you know, I mean, you've earned the position, obviously, but it's okay for him. He gets free bait, all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
you know, what would you suggest to people who are paying for the bait? Is it cheaper alternatives to do the same thing with? Is it all about the areas?
Okay, well, I mean, for a kickoff. Yeah, and let's talk about an 80mm boilie. Yes, it's a pricey thing, and most people can't afford to go buy tons and tons of it and throwing it in. Why not turn an 80mm boilie into four baits and break it into quarters, you know?
Yeah.
And then put that in the lake, yeah? A boilie doesn't have to be, you know, people just, they fire it out with a catapult, they put it out with a throwing stick, blah, blah, blah. But there is so much more you can do with a boilie. You can go from a whole boilie to turning it into a particle. You can use different size baits and stuff. You know, and if you can get older, smaller baits, it's those individual items that I like. Yes, mass baiting does work if it's done properly. If you don't start out throwing 10 kilos in, as I said, and build it up slowly over the course of time, then you'll get where you want to go. But the most important thing of all, regardless of how much you put it in, is the regularity with which you put it in.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be tons of it. I am in a position, I don't do it all the time either, because it is unrealistic. But that's what I did. I'm not going to tell you I did something different. That would be lying to people. I put an awful lot of bait in there, but I've done very similar things but with the regularity with which it goes in. And always bait up just after dark in the winter as well, because there won't be a lot left if you do it in the day.
Tufties.
Yeah, absolutely. Tufties and coots, yeah, the bane of my life. But at least if you do it just after dark, you've got quite a few hours, maybe 15 of them in the winter when those carp can get in and take full advantage. But yeah, regularity is the thing. You know, you get up an hour earlier before you go to work, go to the lake and put it in. You know, if your wife and kids will put up with it, you know, going on the way home. You know, there are sacrifices that have to be made. There's no point moaning about things if you aren't prepared to push the boat out and do what's necessary. You know, you just have to accept what life's going to offer you. But I've always, you know, striven to take things as far as I can, and baiting up in the winter is one of those things. But regularity is the main thing.
Yeah, you know, Jamie said this to me a long, long time back. It's one of the little things that sticks in your mind. I remember him saying,
yeah,
if you're the only one in your street putting bread and crumbs in your garden every morning, that's where all the birds are going to be.
Yeah,
and we were talking absolutely about this exact same thing, and
yeah,
one of the little things that sticks in my mind.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, absolutely. That's a very, very good way of putting it. You know, we often make things up horrendously in carp fishing because we can't see them. But Jamie's example of those birds, and they're animals just like a carp, is exactly right.
Yeah. Oh, there's another water I've got to ask you about. So we talked about, you know, your low stock lakes and then, you know, the massive ray spree. And, there's one what I've enjoyed reading about and, you know, seeing pictures is, Ashmead.
It's my favourite place on the planet. There will never, ever, ever, ever be another place like that. Blimey, we could have spent hours talking about Ashmead, to be honest with you. And probably one of the overriding things is it's in the West Country. As I said earlier, we didn't know carp were invented when I was a kid back then in the West Country because they simply weren't there. And to go to Ashmead and discover something like that. Mark Walsall, who is now a good friend of mine. I speak to Mark as regularly as I can. And the only problem, I want to go back. I want to go and fish it. My problem is, I've caught all the big ones in there, or the ones that were big then. And I don't, I hate catching the same fish again. And when we come to talk about that big one, I'll tell you why I left. But yes, it is a remarkable place, run by a remarkable man. And I absolutely loved it there.
Yeah, it sounds like. Can you just give me a little bit of a description of the nature of the lake? Because it looks like, you know, from reading Mark's Cartwheeled articles, you know, just for the people who've never read that, it just looks like a load of, like, you know, channels, and it looks like a stalker's paradise.
It is, really. I think what Mark needs to do is get a drone and pop it up in the air in an article, and so you can actually see it. There was actually two lakes on it originally, one called Goat Willow, and I forget what the other one was called. Damn, I can't remember what it was called. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Goat Willow was about 2.5 acres, triangular lake, and just over to the right as you went in, Tom's Pit it was called, and that little pit was fished by one guy called Tom. There were a few carp in it, and obviously the bigger ones in Goat Willow. And all around the outside, about 20 acres, I believe, was this channel, a rod length and a half wide, went all the way around, and there were carp in there originally, but they stocked carp into it. I think it was 1991, which is where Single Scale and the other big guys came from. Yeah. 10 miles up the road, the Surrey Trait Farm they came from, and they were stocked into there and grew on, you know. But what Mark did when he bought that place, 2007. His name is Alan, his main man, wonderful people. They came up with a plan one night in the pub, and they joined it all together. They dug things out, and they created probably the most unique environment I've ever been carp fishing in. It's just got, apart from casting the long way, it's got everything you'd ever want in the most amazing environment. The wildlife there is incredible. You know, I don't know. Have you ever had a liner from a sparrowhawk? I have. You know, and it was just incredible. I loved every second of it. I could wax lyrical for hours, mate, and bore everybody to death. But it was so special, and it still is.
Yeah. So I know I mentioned you know, Single Scale. What other units were swimming around in? What was the general stock?
What his mate was, I mean, there's a lot of little commons in there, but they're growing on now, and I think there's probably 8 or 9 40-pound commons in there now. I mean, Single Scale's still going as a mid-50. His mate Moonscale, which has been up to about £49. There's quite a few of them. Most of the big fish in there are commons. He lost a couple along the way, unfortunately, probably through being a bit spawn bound or whatever.
Yeah.
But the stock is just absolutely incredible. And they spawn well in there, which is a sort of good news, bad news thing, you know. But I think Mark's been taking them out and putting them in another little pond. And hopefully, I mean, he might be able to make a business out of that. I don't know. But yeah, I think controlling the stocks is quite a difficult thing if you want fish to grow on. But it's a very natural environment. I think that's why the fish spawn so successfully.
Yeah, natural environment, that's just what I love. You know, the lake I've joined this year, it's so overgrown. I'm glad I've got 13-foot rods just to get cast down the bank.
But it's mad. But you've got the Avalon Flats that run down from Glastonbury down into Taunton. And that's all gravel. You know, you've got the River Test down there that runs through it, which, and those gravel, you know, the gravel underneath the ground is what makes the environment so great, the aquatic environment so great. The further you go down into the West Country, the nearer the peat and acidic soil gets nearer to the surface. And it just means the carp won't grow big, you know? And Ashmead is positioned in the most amazing place, and it's what sustains it in such a healthy way. It really is incredible. And, you know, as far as winter fishing, that winter I started down there, it doesn't get any better than that, really. It was frighteningly good.
That sounds good. So, well, frighten us then. What was the fishing like then? Was it... typical small water spooky fish, or?
Yeah, you know, you're sneaking about looking for them, but ultimately, as I'm always doing, we talked about bait earlier, yeah. I'm looking for that spot. And there was a little, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this word, but it was the fish's name. There was a little white koi in there,
yeah.
And his name was Shagger. And when they were spawned, all you could see was this little white dart going around trying to get in laid, and it was quite incredible. But the first fish I caught there was a 21-pound sort of scattered linear, and it was an incredible place. But I stalked them from everywhere, and it was wonderful. It was great. Nothing big to begin with, and eventually I climbed a tree on this little island. There were only two telegraph poles to go over. There's an actual bridge there now, and I just had to shuffle across with my gear, and I climbed this tree and I saw this little white koi bombing about, and he went down to the right. There's a very shallow channel that went through, you could wade across. And I found single scale. And every time I went there after that, I found the fish. The problem I had, that particular fish, and I baited that spot. I'd never put more than 50 boilers on it, but I kept bait going on it. And that's how that began. But it took a couple of months because the lake kept on freezing. Then it would defrost, and I'd get there and have a go. I was having a few fish along the way, and I was totally enjoying it. I don't think I blanked. And it was great. But I wanted to concentrate on that spot. And the day that I set up, it was the 27th of January 2009, I gave Lynn a ring at about 7:05 in the evening, and I said, if I get a bite tonight, I know which fish it will be. Later on in the early hours of the morning, that rod, I had a single bleak, and the way that I had it set up, I knew it would be a fish. And and that was it. The rest is history. 53 pounds and 12 ounces of pure winter carp, and it absolutely incredible. And that, going back to the bait thing, happened because of bait application, and of course, a little white carp called Shagger.
I tell you what, I love names of carp like that. It's, I think it's being named after someone's granny or something.
But yeah, absolutely.
But, I know an angler called Shagger as well, but that's another story.
Love it.
Yeah. But now, there's, that's what we mentioned earlier on. You're very prolific in the writing side of things in fishing. I mean, now you mentioned it all, kind of like you know, snowballs from the capture of Jack onwards to, you know, what would you say to any...
Sorry.
I was going to say, you know, how does it, you know, how did you, you know, first get into it? Because I've got to be honest, I've got to be in the zone to do it, you know.
Yeah, I found, amazingly, that I just absolutely love it.
Yeah.
I really, really like to write. I don't necessarily like writing technical articles. They tend to just like pulling your toenails out with a pair of pliers sometimes. But, yeah, they need to be done. I totally understand that. But, again, we'll go back to Jack and can't talk Paddy Webb again. He gave me a little tinkle and said, you know, he said, would you write us, you know, 1,000 words on your capture of Jack? And I did it. And when it appeared, everybody in the magazine industry, you know, wanted me to start writing from. Evidently, I have an ability, and it's not a taught one. School and me never, ever got on, believe you me.
I can relate to that.
I have the ability, it's like 1 in a million or whatever, to write as I speak.
Yeah.
And it makes your writing a little bit more interesting. You know, I've never written and my right hand rod went off and all the, you know, these very, very, I write in a certain way and people liked it. And I haven't really looked back. I've stopped doing a diary in the magazines now, which I wasn't sure about would be a good thing. And it's probably the best thing that's ever happened to me in the last 16 years, not writing a diary.
Yeah.
But I can do the fishing that I want to do, and you know, although at this moment in time, I do not have one single ticket for one water in my pocket.
Wow.
How mad is that?
Wow, so you're...
We'll change it, hopefully.
Yeah, right. I went through a season like that myself, you know, a couple of years back, not a single ticket, but, you know, I barely fished. I was moving house and just had other stuff to do, but, you know, I say moving house.
Yeah, well...
Go on.
Sorry, I exactly the same. I mean, after Christmas, I wanted to do the third book. And I had it in my mind how I wanted to do it, and I thought about it for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I sat down at the beginning of February, and by the end of February, I'd written 151,000 words. And by the end of the following month, I'd sorted all the pictures out, captions, forewords, everything, all gone off to the publishers. Angling Publications are going to do it, which I'm really proud about. I've always wanted to do something with Tim like that and the girls. So, yeah, it's been that was it. And that really sort of set the scene for the year. I forgot to do anything else, like get tickets and stuff. So I've just been bobbing around fishing various places and thoroughly enjoying myself. So that's what it's all about.
Yeah, we're back to the F word.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, with a capital F. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's very, very true. But yeah, the writing has been unbelievable. You know, some months I was writing 4 or 5 articles. They're absolutely incredible. And I will hopefully, you know, we'll ignite this writing thing all over again. I'm still doing the odd one here, there, and everywhere. I've got a regular one in Carpology, which I enjoy, looking at carp fishing from a slightly different angle. But, I'll get back into it, and we'll see where it goes. But I just got to wait for this third book to be out, and that'll be then I can start looking at my fishing again.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to your next book, third book, because your book, Light My Fire, it's one of the few books where you're reading it, and I've got your voice in my head as I'm reading it.
The thing is, I have had an interesting life. I'd like to write a book about my military career. I don't know that I can, or even if I want to, but I don't want it just to be, look at me, I caught this carp. Some of the books you pick up, it's, you know, and this would be boring me saying it. This is the lake I wanted to fish. This is me fishing it. This is what I did, and here's the carp I caught. Chapter 2. This is the lake I wanted to fish. This is what I did, and here's the carp I caught. And that's how the books go, and I find that horribly boring. I want more of them out of the book. You know, I don't think they all need to be totally, totally about carp fishing. Fanning the Flames, the latest one, has to be by its very nature, because that's what's going on in your life. But I've tried to throw a few other funnies in there for sure.
Yeah, I think, well, entertainment is the word, and well, in your face, but one of the stories that does stick out to me is when you had some sort of altercation in your early, I think it was an army lake, and you ended up one shovel to the good.
Oh, no. Oh, that was with Jim Foster. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that's the one. Yeah, it's really the story.
We were in our underpants trying to catch a carp from this army lake. And he waded out of the lake to get the photographs of me playing this fish. I'm playing the fish in my underpants. Yeah, and we lifted out, put it on the unhooking mat, and threw these roads of dead bushes, and this army patrol came along, and it was shit. It doesn't get any more embarrassing than that. Yeah, and they sent me the Royal Military, the civilian police guards, they came out in their van, and oh dear, I wanted for the world to open up and swallow me down. It was as embarrassing as it gets, that was, yeah, for sure. I've forgotten all about that. It's brilliant when you talk to people and they remind you of the crazy stuff that happened in your life. But, yeah, and certainly sharing moments like that with someone like Jim Foster, who is an absolute legend within the car fishing world, was, absolutely fantastic. But, no... Thank you for reminding me. Brilliant.
I've just started your book again, and I was going to have it. Basically, I said I was going to skim read it, but I've just got stuck in again, so I'm going to have to go through the start to finish. It's going to be in my bag, dog-eared as well.
Good man. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is the thing I've got to ask on the media side. You seem like, with the Fox DVDs and stuff, you seem like a real natural at the filming side. Does it come out that way, or...?
I will go back to my army career. I used to have to stand up in front of a room full of 4,000 soldiers and tell them what was going to happen. Brief them on my part of it. I'm not saying I was leading all those men. I was just sort of things that I had to do. So I'm quite used to talking, in front of people and doing things. Yes, I think you're right. Fishing TV got a hold of me, a guy called David Hatter, in 2008. Mm. And we made 5 TV programs. I still think they're brilliant, and unfortunately the channel didn't try and pass them on anywhere else or sell them to give themselves some advertising, much as anything. And I thoroughly enjoy it. I absolutely enjoy it. And again, it's a bit like my writing. I think if you can stand there in front of the camera and just be yourself, then it comes across quite well. But I have to say, in a weird sort of way, I get as much satisfaction out of making those things as I do catching any carp. It's just good. And I work with some really great people. The thing at Fox is incredible. I mean, what a setup that is now, and just the nicest people going, and professional. So as much as I might be quite good in front of the camera, you need good people around you, and I've most certainly got that.
Yeah, definitely a teamwork, and I know one or two other people at Fox, Mark Pitchers, I've met him now and then. He's such a lovely man. And well, when you look at the way marketing the whole fishing industry, I think the likes of Alan Blair and his Urban Banks, and Mark Pitchers, Harry and the Challenge, I just think both of them are brilliant people. They stress them out when there's not one coming out. They want them.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you mentioned Alan. People think because he works for another company, you don't like them. You know what I mean? There's quite a few people in this industry I'd never share any time with, and I don't mind saying that. But Alan is such a great guy, and he shows angling off in such a wonderful way. Yeah, brilliant. And, I have so much time and respect for him. But Mark Pitchers, I mean, he comes from County Durham, for course.
That's the Outer Hebrides.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like another hemisphere to me down here in the South. But he has, him and Harry, as you rightly said, and Harry should be thrown into that mix, have made an absolutely incredible series, and it works on every level. I think you only need to look at sort of, the internet response to it as being, it's bordering on biblical. Mark's such a nice guy. He comes across so well, so naturally. He's not pretending to be something he isn't, and I think that's the great thing about what Mark does.
Yeah, when you speak to him on the phone, you know, you're talking to the same Mark that is doing his challenge. You know, it's not
absolutely.
You know, he's not kind of going into character or, you know, like you say, pretending and
no.
You know,
not at all. No, he's a very good man.
Yeah, no, he's brilliant, and it's all good because I like being entertained. In between Fail Army, it's challenges and everything else.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, I think failures are as good as a capture. I mean, I work with a guy, I mentioned his name just now, David Harris. He used to cheer if I lost the cart because, you know, it was real. That's what happens in the world. And, you know, no names, no pack drill, of course, but, you know, there are TV programs out there where it's all sweetness and light, and just want you to watch this program and realize that I think I'm the best angler that ever was, and I think that's wrong. I think, you know, we did, when was it? 2011. I was up at Manor. I'd actually caught I was nothing to do with the filming, but Scott Day and Harry were up there to do some filming with Rob Hughes, and yeah. I'd caught my target fish from there, which was great because they could film it, but they had a couple of swims further up the lake, and Scott, I still believe you'll hate me for saying it, he lost Kendi's linear, I think, that day. But we left it, you know, I didn't, they left it in the filming. And I think that is, carp fishing needs to be portrayed as in reality, not in somebody's dream world. And I think that's what Mark Pitches does, and I think that's what we've done at Fox, and I love every minute of it.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, he's smashed some of his challenges and he's failed others, and it is real. But, you know, it just reminded me, there's one of my favourite rock bands. I've got a line from a song, it just says, "Prevail by daring to fail." Yeah, because every failure, it spurs you on. I think that's a perfect line.
It's a brilliant line, mate. Yeah. It's, you know, being frightened of failure is... you know, you ain't going to get anywhere if you're frightened to fail, you know. It's it's difficult. But a lot of people want to, they want to, they think because it's portrayed as successful all the time, that they should be successful all the time. And I am the first to admit and hold my hand up, when you failed as many times as me, you'll realise that is just part of the game, you know? And it's what makes every success so much better. That's the thing.
Yeah, it's all reality. I mean, that's just reminding me about failing. I've got to wait for the level on my local little river to drop so I can wade across and get all my floats out the tree again.
Yeah, where they've all ended up.
Yeah. Yeah, there's at least three in there.
I don't know when it's going to drop. We've had that much.
Yeah.
I like that, I think.
It sounded like a Christmas tree. It's going embarrassing.
Yeah, you might have to wait a while, the amount of rain we've been having. Like I say, it's just ridiculous at the moment, but there you go.
Yeah, that's true. We need
British summertime, eh?
Yeah, definitely. We need some, like I'm fishing, they're not even spawned yet, so I'm hoping we get some nice hot weather in the mid-20s and they can get it over with. But
we were doing some filming, me and Ian Russell, at the beginning of the week with Fishing TV, and these carp. I can't tell you what happened with the result, but the thing that amazed me was how much spawning activity was going on. You know, not they weren't spawning, but they were definitely getting rain to it. And, the last few years, most lakes have done it by now, which always worries me when they don't, because it's going to cause casualties, bless them. But let's hope they get out of the way. Like you say, a couple of days of 24, 25, and hopefully they'll do the wild thing, which is great.
Yeah, so hopefully now we're on a bit of a different tack. You know, we've been doing this chatting part for nearly an hour now. Time flies when you're...
Really?
But that's when you know it's going to be, a good podcast, a good chat, when it just seems to fly by in an instant. But I've got to ask you... I've got to ask you about, the thing we touched in, before. You achieved quite a lot on the political scene in fishing with Echo.
Yes, it was, I look back on it, it's sometimes I'm angry, sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I feel what I did a lot, sometimes I think I wasted my time. And that's only because of the emotions that it engenders, you know? But yeah, it was harder than, because I didn't write about it in Light My Fire. I wrote about it just a few brief words at the end, and I tried to give the two people that drove it more than anybody else the credibility they totally and utterly deserve. But it's something needed to be said.
Yeah.
And angling is, and still is to a great extent, because I'll come to that in a minute. I don't agree with the way that we're represented hardly at all, apart from the Predation Action Group, which I think is a good thing. But yeah, it's something needed to be said. Our country would have got swamped with carp from as far away as Australia. People were going to fly them in, for goodness sake. You know, we are more than capable of sustaining a carp fishing industry. You know, you talk to people like Viv Shears and Simon Scott and plenty of other places that breed quality fish, and we can sustain it. I never understood why we want to bring those fish in, distort our history, and drag, more to the point, countless different diseases into the country. And I learned so much about it by talking to people in all the negotiations we did, but ultimately you know, we got within a hair's breadth of achieving everything we wanted, but it didn't. But ultimately we achieved getting angling into the public eye, which is something that the people in angling politics now don't want to admit. They want to think they're the ones that are doing the business. Well, that is a load of old rubbish. They are riding full square on the back of the doors that Echo opened up. And if this angling politics, which I don't think it will ever, gets anywhere, then that is the reason it did. And, you know, I don't often be that verbose about what I did with Echo, but that is the truth, whether they like it or not. So there, I said my piece.
Yeah, and well, I said this is a platform for it, and
it's difficult for people to understand. You go out to Westminster and talk to these people. We sat around a table one day, and it was like 27 people that can have an influence. You know, several of them had their advisors with them, and legal people, and you know, we'd come up with a game plan, and it just fell to pieces because they want to drag things out. You know, that's what politics is in this country. We've just gone through a general election, and I'll be brutally honest with you, I don't sign the electoral roll. I've got no I have no right to complain about it, but I didn't sign an electoral roll because I don't think any of those people know what the hell they're doing, and all they're doing is looking after themselves and not the country that they're supposed to be looking after, and that kind of annoys me, really. I don't want to get any more political than that. I'll just get into trouble.
I know I've got my own views on the politics, and especially a certain local politician who I've had a bit of backwards and forwards with on a totally separate issue, nothing to do with fishing, but was, you know, you're explaining everything that's wrong, and you just keep going, the bullshit stock answer back, and you just think, why am I banging my head against the brick wall here? Well, that was my experience anyway.
Yeah, no, and that is mine, and I think you'll find it's everybody else's. You know, have you ever seen a politician that can say yes or no? You know, they have to come out, like you say, with these cock and ball stories that just, you know, they try and talk it away, and it just, you know, most people, I think, just get fed up with it. They've got their own lives to try and sort out. Well, those lives are being ruined by politicians. But again, so that is only my opinion.
I don't necessarily... agree with a lot of what he says, but Donald Trump's certainly entertaining and doing it a different way over in the States. But
I think he's entertaining for sure, but would you want that man in charge of your country? I'm sorry.
Oh, not with that haircut.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah,
I mean, definitely
I
not.
Think, yeah, one of his companies must be a hairspray company, I think, to keep that lot in position.
But it's
strange, mate. But we've got a, you know, we touched on it briefly then with angling politics, yeah. You know. What a load of rubbish. You know, they haven't got a clue. And, you know, we have no names, no packs again, but we have ex-members of Parliament trying to get involved, and they're talking exactly as they did when they were trying to sort out the problems of their constituencies, which gets absolutely nowhere. And I don't think angling deserves that. I think it should be run by anglers and talked about by anglers, and the problems of angling need to be addressed. And we do have a few at the moment, unfortunately. We do have a few.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the Predation Action Group. I think that is an organisation that deserves the support of every caring carp angler out there, because otters are a real threat, and other predators.
Absolutely, but they've picked up on other things, you know what I mean? It's not just, they've tried to accentuate the problems that all fishing have got in this country, and that it's wonderful. Carp fishing's 85% of the fishing done in this country, so quite rightfully should have massive representation, but it's difficult. Again, you know, fish live underwater. People can't see them, and it doesn't mean anything to anybody, you know? You can't shoot a cuddly animal with fur because you see it every day. But people don't know, you know, a 40-pound carp, God knows what you can get for a 40-pound carp. 10, 12 grand? You know, I don't know. I don't know what they're worth, but they're worth a lot more than a sheep. If my dog gets into a field and bothers a sheep that's worth £35, believe it or not, that farmer can shoot my dog. But I cannot protect my tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of carp in a lake because an otter wants to eat them. And they don't even eat them, do they, really? They just kill them and leave them to rot on the bank.
Kill them, tear a strip, and then that's it. But I know they're doing their best and what have you, a lot behind scenes that we'll not know about. But my personal opinion is I don't think much will happen unless the RSPB start losing some of their prized birds to otters, which I'm sure they will and have, until it becomes a serious problem for them, because they've got, I'll say it, a bigger pair of balls than the Angling Trust will ever have.
Well, yeah, and the other thing is they've got infinitely more money. That's the problem.
Yeah, that is another big thing.
And money talks. But, yeah, you're right. And things do happen. I do believe that the PAG talked to a whole host of other people around the place. The unfortunate thing is, as with any waterway, we will always be, as anglers, third-class citizens. You look at a boat in lake, and you angle on that lake. You have no say in it. The people who have the say are the boat people, and we will always be third class citizens as fishermen. And we need to represent ourselves. How we do that, I mean, I've got a very good idea how I do it. Whether that's socially acceptable or not, I don't know. But sometimes, if you don't say what you feel, then you get what you deserve. And I don't think fishing, with its social responsibilities, its environmental impact, and the industry that is created, deserves to be treated in the feeble way that governments and local authorities do treat us. You know, we pay a lot of money into this economy. Fishing brings a lot of joy to an awful lot of people, and I think that we need some help. And we could do it if we could unite. But the problem is, and this is probably the biggest problem of all, fishing is an individual pursuit.
Yeah.
And we do it as an individual. We don't do it as a team. It isn't tribal like football. It's an individual thing. And I've probably gone on far too long. I do apologize.
No, not at all. I'm enjoying this. And I've just lost my thread there. I have something to say, but I've totally forgotten. It's gone black. You know, you do these things, you get all your notes in front, you follow so many of them, and then it just turns into a chat or a rant.
I think we are having a very good conversation as it happens, and it was just, you know, you might have covered the political side of it, and I've probably got a little bit more to say than some because simply because I've been involved. But I'm very proud, as I said, to put a cover over all of that of what Echo did. It's just that a lot of cowardly people that are trying to run angling politics won't admit that we opened all the doors for them. You know, two or three very brave people, they don't want to, you know, they want to behave like politicians, and if we behave like politicians, we'll never get represented, and that's the end of that. That's my opinion, of course.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. I was going to, you know, slightly less political. I was going to give, you know, a bit of credit for, you know, Danny Fairbrass and his embryo project.
Absolutely. Danny, you know, Danny dives in and does stuff. And you can look at people like Danny and say, yeah, he's just trying to take care of number one. But I think Danny, and I will take you right back to Echo.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I've ever said this publicly before. Danny put £20,000 a year into Echo. Do you know that?
I didn't know that.
Over a 4-year period. And, you know, we've had our moments, me and Danny. I'm telling you that now. But I have the utmost respect for what he's trying to do for angling on various levels, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get on with everybody on this planet, but, you know, he's done an awful lot for carp angling, and he continues to do that. And you know, yes, he works for a company that is, you know, works in the same market as the company that I work for, but that shouldn't be the point. We need to look at what individuals can do for fishing, and Danny has tried his best in a whole host of different areas.
Yeah, definitely, and I think that's a very positive note to end this chat on the hour and 10 minutes. So I just want to thank you greatly. I want to thank you greatly for speaking to us. Before we go, just give us all a bit of an info on your third book. When's it out, and where can we get it?
Right, okay, yes, thanks for that. Yeah, it's called Fanning the Flames. It goes from the very second I picked up my barrow and walked out the swim after Charlie's mate up until October 2015. It's, yeah, Fan in the Flames, being published by Angling Publications, the foreword's by Tim Paisley, and it will be out. We have a release party, if you like, at the Circus Tavern in Essex, and that is on the 11th of November. That is Remembrance Day. I will go and pay my respects to my fallen friends and people that have defended this country, and then I will get a chance to go and release my book. So hopefully I'll see a few of you there.
Brilliant. Thanks again, Ian Chilcott.
Thank you. Wow.
Feels like I'm in love. Just had the first time I met you.
Big thank you to Chili, thoroughly enjoyable chap, thoroughly knowledgeable as well. On the net, Mark, big news at Carp Team England.
It's on the net, it must be true.
Yeah, we got sent a actual press release. It makes us feel like an official media outlet, that.
Yeah.
From Bev Clifford. That was Carp Team England men's and ladies team. They had an evening at the new Arcade Leisure Raisbury Lodge. They celebrated the success of both teams over the past 12 months, where, well, let's be honest, they've just smashed up everywhere they've been, and so we invented carp fishing in England.
Yes.
And there's also quite a lot of news, although we'll not go too in-depth on it, because when you got to the next Hughes news coming up?
Yeah.
Well, Rob will want to tell us all about it.
Yeah, I'll try and speak to Rob next week. We were invited, by the way, to that evening, but unfortunately we couldn't attend. But a shout out to Rob for thinking about us. But yeah, there is loads of news. Do you want to go over it briefly?
Yeah, can do. The ladies are going to head over to Wales to defend their Anglo-Welsh Cup title that they won in April. There's also planning underway for an international tournament involving England, Wales, Holland, France and Italy.
Ah, so that's, That'd be good.
Yeah, the ladies carp fishing taking off and growing, and you know, do you think that'll ever evolve into a full world championships for them? I hope so.
Yeah, that'd be great. It's a Rob Hughes said it's a great time for international carp fishing. I've always said that to be successful at the highest level, we need to compete on the international stage more. That's exactly what we're doing. We've had some great success over the past 12 months and are aiming for that to continue. Our team is stronger in the preparation for the World Championships in France in September. Ladies' team's been an immense success as expected. Other nations now want to field ladies' teams as well. Rob has been fantastic, hasn't it? All this stuff is no coincidence that since Rob took over the role of Team England manager and he got his position with Sport England representing fishing, that things are really happening, aren't they? So, obviously, Rob will speak about himself, but he's covering all this stuff on BT Sport as well, which seems to be the channel to have these days. If you're into sports, all sports. Rob will tell us more when we get him on. I'll try and speak to him for next week actually as well, but yeah, big news at Carp Team England, and obviously we wish the country success. Anything else you've seen on the net?
It's on the net, it must be true.
Yeah, just a couple of quick things. This is something that seems to pop up every year. I know we've mentioned it before last summer. Don't get wheels disease, because it doesn't look like much fun.
No. Who's had it this time? Have you?
I've actually seen a couple of people on my Facebook feed who, you know, just posting little selfies in hospital where they've got drips hanging out of every orifice. And well, just to recap, wheels disease, you catch it from any open cuts or sores from rats' pee-pee.
Yes,
so also, you do. don't leave your pots and pans lying around either. You know, it's easy for a rat to have a pee on it in the night, and then... And then you're in hospital. Don't do it.
Yeah, it looks like a very, very seriously bad fever that you get. It doesn't look fun at all. It looks like horrendous flu, and it can kill you. So, yes. I always take hand sanitizer with me. I actually have it everywhere. It's probably because I'm getting old, and I'd have never dreamt that as a young whippersnapper charging around lakes. But I have one in my van. I have one in me little man bag that I carry around wherever I go, because I play a lot of poker as well, as we've spoke about before, and lots of sweaty men handling the poker chips and stuff. You can see the dirt on them a lot of time, and quite often you're in a poker casino for 8, 9, 10 hours at a time, because the competitions last days sometimes, and then you have to eat during that time, and you're handling these chips that everybody else is handling and getting passed around the table. It's a bit like money, you know. Money's very dirty, isn't it? The last thing you want to do is, you know, get a handful of pound coins from your local corner shop and, you know, handle them in and out of your pocket and then eat a bag of crisps. It's like the last thing you want to do without sanitizing your hands. But yeah, I have them everywhere these days, and they're especially useful for when you're fishing, because obviously it's pretty dirty.
You're using the example of eating. There's worse things that everybody does when we go to the toilet. We go through all the motions, the paperwork of that, and well, we all know not everybody washes their hands afterwards. And
no.
Just out of curiosity, has anyone ever taken a bunch of poker chips down to the local lab and analysed them to find out exactly what bacteria and nasties are on them? Or would that scare you off poker for life?
I'm not aware of it, but yeah, I mean, some of the good card rooms is there. One of the best card rooms is Dusk Till Dawn in Nottingham, where I play a lot, and they actually have hand sanitizers all around the room. Some casinos do. It helps to keep the chips clean as well as obviously, you know, helping us. But yeah, it's pretty nasty if you actually think about what's on a lot of the stuff that we touch. But how we got there from wheels disease, I don't know. But take your hand sanitizer, only like a quid for the little ones that fit in your pocket or in a little bag or something.
Yeah, I do remember. I think it was the peanuts on a bar. The bowl of peanuts was analysed for what was in there, and there's quite traces of quite a few different types of urine.
Yeah, can you imagine just like, yeah, but let's not go there. Anything else you've seen on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
There's another quick one I thought I'd put in. Be careful with candles, because to quote Georgie Swims, waking up on fire wasn't the one. And accompanying this was pictures of a bed chair and pillow and a sleeping bag
quite well torched, and also a few blisters as well, where the flames had burnt her. And have you ever set yourself on fire?
I have got a candle story, yes.
really, that's a coincidence.
I went to fish the church lake. I was invited down in the middle of winter one year to test out the RS1s, was it? The very first Nash alarms? They were on prototypes. I had to sign a privacy agreement before I was allowed to look at them, because they were so different looking to any other alarm that had previously been out. And obviously there were some new features on them that had never been on any alarm, the speed sensing and stuff, which they still have on the R3s, which I like. So I was invited down to the church to use these alarms and to fish. The lake froze while I was there. I think there was one night that I actually got some rods in out of the three nights. Yeah, the alarms worked fine, as all rollers can do. In when it freezes, they can freeze up. But a little squirt of WD-40 sorts that out, by the way, if you didn't know. They didn't freeze up on this particular occasion. It just cropped into my mind. I was in a stage of using candles. I would bang a bank stick into the ground, and I would use elastic bands to tape a candle to the bank stick. And obviously in the winter the nights are really long. It's dark at 4:30. It's not light till 8:00 in the morning, and having a candle, I don't know if it gives off heat in a bivvy. It probably does give some sort of effect when it's been burning for a little while. Probably just takes like the chill off the air. But it's just the feeling, the atmosphere. When you've got a candle in a bivvy, it makes it feel better. And obviously you're not sleeping for that entire time from 4 p.m. till 8:00 in the morning. So you're doing stuff, reading books and whatever, cooking. I don't know what you do to pass the time. But having a candle on the background is really nice. But I just picked up a new bivvy that I'd ordered. I'd picked up the Titan Brolly when that first came out, and the winter skin for it. I've set it up, and the candle was quite a long candle, and it was a little bit high to the roof because the bank stick, the only spare bank stick I had was quite a long one, and I've taped this thing to it anyway. And I'm actually sat with Reedy, who was working at Nash at the time, and I put a hole right through both layers of the brand new bivvy that was it was about 6 hours old. I've been using this bivvy, so I couldn't take that bivvy home. I had to leave it with Nash. Have a set of seamstresses and stuff. They do their own repairs, you know, in the UK. So if you send something back, or you break it and want, you know, you rip it or whatever, and you want it fixed, you can send it back to them. Or you used to be able to. I'm pretty sure you still can. And you know, they actually fix it in house. So they were good enough to patch it for me. I still have that Brolly, and it has a little square patch on the winter skin and the normal skin. Fortunately, it didn't catch fire, which I can only think is because materials have to be fire treated, don't they, on tents and stuff, and obviously bivvies. So if you're buying one for a reputable company such as Nash or any of them, Tracker, Fox, whatever, I'm pretty sure they're all flame retardant. So it was testament to the fact that, you know, years ago that bivvy had probably gone up in flames, but it didn't just burn a perfect hole through both layers and didn't catch fire.
Well, depending on the position of the hole, that could have been useful for watching the water at night.
It's in the roof, though. It's good for watching the stars. Yeah, it was in the top. But I've heard of many bivvy stories over the years, usually because of a Coleman keg. Yeah, the Colemans flare up, people panic, kick them, and next thing your door's on fire. I've burnt a few holes in doors, actually, over the years.
Yeah, my old Coleman had two settings, off or inferno.
Yeah,
there was no in between.
It's no good for no good for baked beans, but pretty good for making cups of tea.
Yeah, oh, you boiled your kettle pretty quick. That's if you didn't melt your kettle.
Yeah, yes, I've had many years of Colemans. I don't currently own one, but I would like another one. But yeah, if anybody knows a really good a really good petrol stove that's the generators don't go quite as quickly as a Coleman's, and let us know, because I'm in the market for a new stove.
The newer type of Coleman, not only have you got your little red knob, you've also got which is, you know, your on off, is it always, there's another one around the other side. It's kind of like a black one that goes round, which it gives you a lot more control over the flame. That's worth a look. I think you can about 55, 60 quid.
I shall have a look. Something else that's worth a look is Carpology, I believe.
Worth a look.
Oh, without a doubt, it's a collector's issue.
Is that because you're in it by any chance?
Possibly. I might be exaggerating, but yeah, I was asked by Joe Wright to contribute to the rotary letter.
Ah, yeah, that I did a few of those a few years back.
I've got to be honest, I was quite pushed for time, but I thought, yeah, I'll do it. It's quite an easy article to write in the general scheme of things, you know, between 2,000 and 2,500 words and, you know, a bunch of pictures. And because you're feeding off other people's comments and adding your own opinions in, it flows as one of the easiest articles I've had to write, to be honest. And I've also had a couple of tweets and messages, you know, so people are appreciating it, which it's always good to hear.
Yes. It's certainly worth a look. Get this month's Carpology. We'll move on to some listeners' questions shortly. I mean, we've been running a fair amount of time now, considering we were trying to bash a quick one out.
Don't be rude.
talking of rude, we've had a few requests to our page Beverly Clifford has finished her 22 days of press ups for PTSD awareness. Shout out to Beverly once again, as we do. Could she carry on doing them? Has been the request. I think people don't want them to stop. Just passing that message along, Beverly. On a personal note, by the way, if you want to check out our website, we're going to be putting the new load of Carpcast extras soon. We'll probably release three at the same time, probably release three in a week or certainly over the first couple of weeks, because we know we're behind and we're just locking down the last person now to get them finished up. But most of them are done. There's a great selection of anglers once again going to be on them. But www.thecarpcast.com is where you can find them. You can subscribe to all the previous ones that we've done and the new ones, just a way of supporting the show. We can hopefully get some money back, because it's getting quite expensive, this show now, as is the £3,500 worth of clothing that we bought that's still sat in your shed, is it not, Mark, or in your bedroom?
No, it's in my spare room. If it was in my shed, it would probably smell a bit fusty and the mice would have eaten it. It would smell of krill and shrimp, like the bait I'm using, which can't be smell.
So yeah, what we're going to do, we're going to do a sale on our clothing, because we could do with moving some of it. There are the Carp Gods Giveth t-shirts with the Carpcast logo on the back, so it's the Carpcast Giveth on the front. There are some very good quality hoodies in all sizes, medium, large and extra large, and there are some Carpcast hats, which I'm sure we'll sell in the winter because they're woolly hats. But if you would like to be branded in any of the Carpcast gear, I mean, they all look pretty cool. Yeah, they're all in black, and we're going to be doing a sale. We're going to be knocking 40% off, because we want to move some of it. Keep an eye on our website. I'm going to have a chat with Reese over the next few days to alter the prices in the shop, and we're just going to try and move some of it, because we've got quite a lot of money tied up in that that we could do with shifted. So yeah, we're going to have a sale. I don't know how long the sale will be on for. Probably not forever. Go and check out thecarpcast.com, and you can listen to all the previous podcasts on there as well, and there's a few other bits, there's the odd article on there, and you can just sign up to the newsletter and keep in touch with all things Carpcast. So I think let's do a listener's question. I've had a couple to my Facebook. I've been away for some time, as you will know, so I'm going to catch up on all my questions. So we are a little bit behind on listeners' questions at the minute, but let's do one, Mark.
Ask us a question.
Just the one. Well, we've got a few, but I'll start with this one. Daniel Harrison says, "Hi guys, just wanted a bit of advice regarding pre-baiting." Now, this is something I've put in because it affects everyone, and pre-baiting done correctly is such an edge, something everyone can take advantage of. But Daniel says, "I started to bait a neglected swim on a lake I'm currently fishing.
I've been baiting up a little on Sunday evening and fishing, then putting in a couple of kilos when I'm leaving first thing, then repeating the same on Wednesday evening, baiting Thursday morning before I leave. I'm probably putting 6 kilos of birdseed and a kilo of boilie each week for the last 2 weeks, but only managing 2 visits per week. The idea was to keep the bait steadily going in so I could just drop into the swim for quick overnights, but I'm wondering if only baiting twice a week is enough. I'll just take a quick pause right there, and baiting up twice a week is a hell of a lot of bait better than none at all. You know,
yeah,
all
certainly.
Would be better, but twice a week, I mean, I've done it once a week on St. Ives Lagoon and reaped the rewards, so yeah, twice a week will work 100%. Now he says, the lake is usually busy over the weekend, so it would be difficult to bait then, unless at night. There's your answer. At night, when they're all tucked up in the bivvies, when it's pissing down in rain, you know, just be a bit crafty.
We've spoke about pre-baiting a number of times in the past, and I've kind of given up trying to pre-bait busy lakes. You can never guarantee. The whole point of pre-baiting for me is to give the fish a free food without any lines in the water. So if somebody's fishing those pegs in between you baiting, it's defeating the object of what you're doing. Somebody else is just going to reap the benefit. So that aside, I wouldn't even attempt anymore to, you know, all baits are good enough to catch carp. You know, there's lots of good companies out there, and there are some exceptional ones, and there's some exceptional baits out there. If you're fishing on fish with a really good bait, you're going to catch fish. So having pre-baited for 3 weeks and having somebody else fish, you know, those areas in between isn't going to catch you any more or less fish. I don't think it makes any difference. The fish they eat when they're there. If you're getting on fish, if you want to drag a fish to an area of the lake, I mean, if there's an area where nobody fishes, as soon as you start baiting and regularly and fish start showing over that area, somebody's going to go in it. Now, occasionally a syndicate will leave somebody alone, but you can't bank on that. You can't, it's not something you can just presume is that people are just, oh, so-and-so's baiting that peg. If I come down to a lake and the lake's empty and the fish are all nutting out in one particular peg, I don't want to be in a position where I feel like I can't go in that peg because I know you've been baiting it. So my views on pre-baiting have changed over the years. Now, if you're fishing a lake that doesn't get fished, then different story. I would 100% be pre-baiting. Probably the most successful stint I ever did pre-baiting, I've done a few good pre-baiting plans, but probably the most successful one I ever did was Colmere, which was a lake that housed less than 10 fish in 190 acres, and I ended up getting 5 bites over the period of 2 weeks by pre-baiting twice a week. It was 100 miles from my house, so I couldn't bait it every day. I was baiting it on a Monday or Sunday when I arrived fishing. I would obviously fish where I was going to fish, and I would make a point of baiting 8 different spots around the lake, making sure I'd covered the whole lake, you know, a spot on each of the winds, and then I would bait it again. I'd spend 2 hours walking around the Thursday before I left to drive home, and if I couldn't fish 1 week, I would try and get there twice during that week, like the same again, Monday and the Thursday. So twice a week is enough. It did do the job. The fish were definitely on the bait, and they were definitely in the areas that I was baiting. They started showing over the areas that I was baiting. And bearing in mind, it was a bit of a needle in the haystack, super low stock, and not many fish in a very big lake. Then it certainly worked. I've also done it the other way, where I'm just baiting one peg. I used massive success one March by heavy baiting, when most people are using single hook baits and when there's no weed in the lake. On that particular lake, they used to use single hook baits and PVA bags, casting as far as they could to the island, which is where the fish seemed to wake up, because there was no weed about, so they just used the only cover, which was the island. And I had almost a season's worth of fish for a lot of the syndicate in 3 days by baiting every other day for a week, which also works. I've done that on other lakes. So every 2 days I think if you can do a much more condensed, if the reason why I did it on wire was because the ticket was running out. It ran out the 31st of March. I hadn't fished it that year because I'd been fishing down at Elstow, and I thought, right, I want to try and get some money's worth out of this ticket before I leave, because I knew I wasn't rejoining. And it was the middle of March. Obviously, if you bait too early, the fish haven't really woken up. So I waited till the water temperature started getting near 50 degrees Fahrenheit, which seems to be the magic number for activity to happen. The first odd fish started coming out the lake, and I baited every 2 days, put like a 20 key bucket in every 2 days on one spot. I baited three times, so over basically 6 days, and then I fished it for 3 days, and it went off. I was getting two takes at a time. It went crazy. I had like probably nearly 20 bites in 3 days, which, you know, for a lot of the syndicate, that's all they would catch in a year. Or you know, the top rods were catching 40, 50 fish a year, but you know, it was a lot of anglers caught 10 fish a year, and I think I had like 20 bites in 3 days. So they're the two methods I would use if I was going to do it. So don't be frightened. And I also did it in the same sort of ratios to what you're using, which is the 6 kilos of bird seed and a kilo of boilies. When you have to pay for your bait, as most people do, and I certainly was during all my pre-baiting campaigns, that's how I would do it. I would use about that ratio, or maybe depending on how big your bucket is and what it keeps. But I used to use a cooler box for my hemp and stuff, so I used to boil it all, and then I would pour it into a cooler box and put the lid on it so it would carry on cooking in the cooler box, get really oily and splitting. And a cooler box would hold about 12 to 15 kilos wet, less dry obviously, would hold about that much. And I'd put 2 kilos of boilies out on top of that cooler box full. So I think the ratio you're using there is pretty right, sort of 6 kilo particle to a kilo of boilies. You don't need loads of boilies in there, you're just trying to get the spot going. So I think you're doing it right. Be careful baiting in the margins because people can see the bait. I think you're doing right.
I do as well. And if you're capable of self-take photography, that's a good age just to keep it quiet, because as I said, people will jump in on a busy lake, and we want you to milk that spot before it's blown and the other anglers are on it. We need you to get the best out of it first, and send us your pictures to our Facebook page.
I've just read another question from Leon Langley here that I kind of want to answer now I've read it. so let's do another listener's question.
So you were question. Talking and reading at the same time. You have a multitask.
I can do that, yes. the only thing I can't do is read and have somebody else talk to me, because I just don't hear a word that they say, according to my girlfriend. She can have a full-blown conversation with me and I have no idea what she said. If I'm looking at the computer, reading something or watching TV, my ears just switch off. I just don't hear. Oh, a single finger, and it frustrates her very much. Sorry, Rachel. Leon Langley, hello lads, loving the Carpcast. Have a question for you both. Have access to a lake near me, approximately 7-8 acres, 20 foot deep in places, old brickworks quarry, stuffed with fish, not open to the public. Leon, where is it?
Ask us a question.
I've never had a problem catching from here, multiple runs with 49 fish in 48 hours last time, but I can't get past mid doubles up to 23 pound. I really want to get into some of the lumps that I know is side in here. There are definitely a number of 30 plus belters in here. Any tips on singling out the bigger residents? It's very snaggy in places, not a lot of weed due to its depths. I await your wisdom, boys. Thanks for the vote of confidence. The problem with heavily stocked lakes that have got big fish in is you generally do have to fish through them. There are certain methods I would do. I would use big fish rigs, which generally the Terry Hearn type stiff rig that does kind of catch slightly less fish but does single out bigger fish. And the main thing I would do is I would have a rod off the baited area 20-25 yards away on a single hook bait. So I would fish out your fishing, catch the fish, if you can use three rods, catch the fish on your two rods on your baited spot, and have a single hook bait 20 even 30 yards away, and do not put a single boilie around it. That picks up bigger fish. I've used that method a lot. It's a very common way of doing it abroad as well, when they use heavy baiting, because sometimes the big fish just hang away from the others. They'll either come in after the other fish have fed, or they'll just pick up the scraps around. They tend to just stay away. We've spoke about the Clifton Park Lake fish. That does that, likes to come 20, 30 yards away from the rest of the fish. I've known a number of fish, big fish, that do that. But yeah, that's what I would do, and you're probably just going to have to fish through them.
Yeah, what I would also try, I don't know what baits you're using, but I would, you know, drop any particles or pellets and just go for a boilie approach. You know, just air dry some 20 mils. Again, you're going to slow it down.
Yeah, boilies do catch bigger fish. That is, yeah. I've had that many times. We've had the discussion about the key many times because Kevin claims that it catches bigger fish. Simon Crowe certainly backs that up with the year he's had since using the key. He's definitely caught all the big ones out of lakes that he's struggled on before. I've seen that happen. I've seen certain boilies outfish other boilies in terms of size of fish, not numbers but size. You know, I've had many times, I've had like 5-1 ratio, and I've had 5 20s on one bait and I've had one big one on the other bait. We've spoke about this a number of times on previous podcasts, so you don't have to go out and buy a Nash key, but if you're looking to solve a problem, then I would start thinking out the box. I'd start thinking of things like that. Who's told you that, you know, certain baits are big fish baits? Not necessarily the key. Maybe there are others you've heard of where some people say, yeah, that's a big fish bait. Terry Hearn used to say the Monster Pursuit was a big fish bait. When he was with Nash many years ago, it was a bait that they came up with, and he reckoned it caught bigger fish. Who's going to argue with Terry Hearn? The guy's a legend of the UK carp fishing scene, hence the name Monster Pursuit. It was a big fish bait. I know the fat lady got caught on that bait a number of times. My very first day on the lake, I watched her get caught on that bait. So maybe have a look down that road, ask a few people that you respect, and then I've just given you two baits there straight away. I'll tell you another one that I don't even know if you can get it anymore, but the Nutribaits Trigger. When I used to just use whatever baits they had in the shop, I remember fishing Mainlines NRG and Nutribaits Trigger on different rods, different baits on different rods, as you do. And I remember catching 5 on the NRG in one session that were all like 18 to 24 pound out of the wire, and I had one take on the Trigger and it was 28 pound. Could have been a coincidence, but I think not. You got anything to add, Mark?
No, but while you're mentioning baits, I'm going to sound like a blatant plug, but the bait I'm on at the minute, not only is it picking out big fish, it's also picking out uncaughts.
Wow.
So I'm getting quite excited with that. It did the the other one that they're doing, the TM1, it picked out the that's what caught the big folly from long reach that had not been out for 5 years, I mentioned a few shows ago.
That few shows ago where we spoke about fish that I've been on the missing list since 2011. They seem to be coming out this year. We also discussed.
There's more, isn't there?
There's a few. Yeah, people keep sending us, and they're all the same. They were last out 2011. Some of them presumed missing. Some of them had been seen, and for some reason they seem to be getting caught this year. If you haven't heard the last Kevin Nash episode, Kevin does a monthly Nash debate. We did speak about it on that, and he had some interesting views as to why this might be the case, but he's saying more conditions is something that's happened this year that must have happened then, you know, such as like a cold winter and then mild and then cold again, or something that's made the food, the natural stuff, grow in a certain way, or it's encouraged certain creatures to come out, which has excited the fish, got them feeding or whatever. But there's something probably, condition wise, environment wise, that's must be the same this year as it was in 2011. Maybe we can get older weather reports and stuff. Can you get detailed, like old weather reports anyway? So a site that does that. If anybody knows, let us know, because I'd be interested to go back, on certain dates and look. And look what it was doing then, on certain occasions like that, like you get a fish that comes out every 5 years. Well, let's see if there's any, let's look for the coincidences. Let's look for things that were the same then as now, and then maybe you can predict stuff in the future.
Yeah, like Old Moore's Almanac, going back to the future.
Carp Talk are a partner of the Carp Cast. They, you can get their digital version of the Carp Talk before it comes out to all and sundry in the news, and you get a digital version downloaded directly to your device: Apple MacBook, iMac, Android, PC, iPad, whatever device you have. You can get it from www.pocketmags.com. It's only $1.49 as well, the digital version. The print version comes out on a Tuesday from your local stockist. You can check the stockist locators on the Carp Talk website, and it's only $1.99. And what have we got in this week's? Oh, by the way, at the end of this little piece, we always tell you about the Carp Talk competition that they have every week. We've been encouraging our listeners to, we want a monopoly of all the prizes, and it seems to have been happening. I keep getting messages from people saying, oh, I won it this week, I won it this week. I bet we've had three out of the last five when we've promoted it. I know we missed a show the last 2 weeks because I've been away, but I am getting messages from people saying that they are now entering the competition, and a number of our listeners are winning. So we'll tell you about the competition in a minute. But what's in the news stories this week?
Oh, there's a bunch of chunks as usual. We've got a 51.9 from Home Fen. That's from Paul Sellens, who we were talking about that lake earlier on. There's also chunks from Frimley Charlie's Mate, which is an absolutely stonking common. Got Mike's Pet from Raisbury from the North Lake. You know, ooh, Black Spot from Eric's.
Yeah, that was one that's been on the missing list, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm going to see how big that is, because that's... that is one of the chunks. Any Yorkshire as well.
Yeah, I think it was low 50s, that one. I think it was the last one of the missing one after the floods, yeah. I think.
Here's one that interests me. I'm going to read, the copy we've got here, word for word. We also expose the origins of the new wonder rig that has burst onto the scene in recent weeks, having accounted for dozens of UK 50s and 40s on the sly.
If ever there was a reason.
Is there such thing as a wonder rig? Well, call me sceptical, but unless there's trebles involved, I'm going to have to see it to make my own mind up, I think.
Well, that's a nice little teaser. If ever there was a reason to buy this week's Carp Talk, that's it. You know, if there's a new rig, you'd be daft not to check it out. Of course, there's all the usual features. Guest of this show, Ian Chilly Chilcott, details his own version of the Hinge Stiff Rig, a rig we've just suggested for one of our listeners' questions, so that's definitely worth checking out. Briggs is on 100-acre Lac de Villadon in France. Terry Edmonds is in there on his new Syndicate Water. And the competition this week, Mark, what can we win?
We can win a load of the new Tasker Vendor throwing sticks.
Yeah,
do you use a throwing stick?
I do. I forgot to take one to Bled and needed one, but yeah. This week's competition is for a Tasker Vendor throwing stick. There's also there's another competition as well, 500 open access cart waters Facebook competition.
That's the one we've already done.
That's our one, is it? Okay.
And, I forgot about that idea, Ed.
And gotcha. Guess the collective weight of the next week's top 10 fish in the Carp Talk interview. Oh, is that for our comp? Or
that's what I thought of earlier on, but we've already done that for something else, so that, or just ignore it.
Now, forget that. The competition to win our two books is send us a pick from an open access water, a water that's free, that you don't pay, that just your national permit, or as I said, in Holland, or even the rod license of said country and a lake, you can just fish without paying. Send us a picture of a fish you've caught from that type of lake, and we'll pick the two nicest, not necessarily the biggest, just the nicest looking, and you will win a guide to 500 other access waters to go and try and catch fish from. That's it for this week. Check out our website, go and buy some discounted clothing, and anything else to add, Mark?
No, not really. I know it's been a long one, but I think our listeners deserve a long one. We've kept them hanging on for this one.
We certainly have. I'm only away. I'm at a festival. I'm back Tuesday, Wednesday next week, so we should have an episode out next Friday as usual. And we we've had our holidays now. We're going to up our game on the Carpcast. We're getting on top of the Carpcast extras. We've got some amazing guests lined up over the next few weeks. We've got some of the hierarchy of angling. Obviously, we've had one this week with Ian Chilcott, and we're going to keep that up. We're going to keep it rocking. So that's it from us. We'll see you next week.
See you then.
Merchandise and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.